Woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil sends the beast with wrath, because he knows the time is short. Let him who hath understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
It is SummerSlam Sunday.
I had to dust a little bit of the demon off there, right? A little bit of Demon Sala Monster. Got my 5 hours of sleep after streaming for over 3 hours last night. Big double stream. Nice hybrid stream talking AEW Dynamite and NXT TakeOver 30. Now I get to wake up this morning and do it all over again for all of you. And then come back tonight and do it again. Live after SummerSlam. In case you couldn't guess it, this is episode 666 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, August 23rd. 2020, I am the Sala Monster, and in the spirit of 666, let me take this moment to wish a very happy birthday, appropriately enough, to one Vince McMahon, who turns 75 years old tomorrow, and watching him on SmackDown Friday night at the Thunderdome, he looked every bit of those 75 years. AudibleTrial.com/SalaMonster, the weekly sponsor of this podcast. Please give that link a visit. Cash in, get yourself one free audiobook when you sign up for the 30-day trial. AudibleTrial.com/SalaMonster. We got a lot to get to this week. We're going to cover a lot of ground. But as we do every week, first thing I want to do is give all of you your props for all of your support. You want to make a PayPal donation, you can do so on thesalamonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page, or the email address, as always, is thesalamonster@gmail.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. And I gotta give this guy his props right up front. The Bangkok Bandit, Nipit Viramatikul, who blew me away this week. Nipit blew me away with his support. My jaw dropped when I opened my email and I saw what I saw. Nipit, you made my week with that. Thank you. I don't know what else to say. I already emailed you. I said, you know, I was speechless. But thank you. You know, the support I get from people like Nipit and others, it just reminds me that I must be doing something right. It's a nice little reminder every week or every now and then that I'm doing something right. And it means a lot to me, so thank you. Same goes to Darkness Falls, Espen Arnston, first-time donator from overseas. Glad to have you aboard, Espen. Thank you for the generous support. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Luscannon Lopez, Deadpool, James Herrera, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Out of control, Cody Thomas, who would like to send a very happy birthday shout out to his nephew, Jordan, who turns 11 years old tomorrow. Happy birthday, Jordan. You know, when you mentioned 11-year-old Jordan, I just got done talking about 10-year-old Jordan, who called into my SummerSlam prediction stream on Thursday afternoon. 10-year-old Jordan from Detroit. One of the best calls I've had, maybe ever. That kid knew what he was talking about. Something about the name Jordan. I'm sure he's a smart kid. The Moldovan masochist, Alexandru Mata, Killshot Keith Hart, Dream Chaser Chauncey Curry, haven't heard from Chauncey in a while, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, Josh the Shooter Stockton, D. Venom, John E. Rue, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, Nitrous Oxide Nathan Cania, who was supposed to be celebrating 6 years together today with his girlfriend Amber on a vacation in Florida, but instead they're celebrating at home, and also today his younger brother Jared, it's his birthday. So, happy anniversary to Nathan, and happy anniversary to Jared. And also, a quick shout-out to Cordaro, who is back in the hospital. He's a fan of the show. He's having some health issues. He's back in the hospital. So, sending positive vibes to you, my friend. I know you're listening, or you will be listening to this. I hope everything works out. And Bodega Body, Rich Sabata. I want to talk about Rich here for a second. Rich has been listening to this podcast since episode 38. So to put that into perspective for you, that goes back all the way. I guess the 38th episode would have been early 2008. So he's been with me for well over a decade, and he is literally half the man that he used to be. He just started a podcast of his own called the Bodega Body Podcast after losing 130 pounds. And on the show, he talks to friends, he talks to folks from really all across the fitness and nutrition and mental health industries about how people can become the healthiest versions of themselves. So give it a listen, the Bodega Body Podcast on all major podcast platforms. And if I may, just to piggyback on the whole fitness thing, you know, when I got back from the Jericho cruise back in, I guess, the end of January, it would have been. And boy, did I just get that in under the buzzer. But when I got back from the Jericho cruise, the first time I stood on the scale, and I had people in my ear telling me, look, you've never been on a cruise before. You're probably going to gain 10 pounds, 10 or 15 pounds. The food is great. You know, it's what happens. I said, nah, you're crazy. And I came back from the cruise, and I was the heaviest I ever weighed in my life. It was 187 pounds. And I know there's going to be some people who hear that and laugh and go, oh, I killed to be 187 pounds again. Well, for me, that was a wake-up call. So, you know, when the pandemic hit and the gyms closed and I started working from home every day and I didn't have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and rush to catch the bus and all that nonsense, I mean, it really wasn't until June. But finally, in June, at the beginning of the summer, I decided, you know what, I'm going to get back into DDP yoga. I fell off of it when I hurt my knee a couple of years ago. I'm going to get back into DDP yoga. I went, I bought a food scale. I got the MyFitnessPal app up and running again on my phone to count calories, not macros. I'm still not really up on what all that means and how all that works. But I'll tell you what, I'm down 16 pounds in 7 months. And you feel it. You really do. You feel it. You just feel better. Except the shin splints when I run. Those don't feel so good. Those have been a relatively new thing that I've been experiencing. I bought a brace. It does help a little bit. I may buy one for the other leg. I'll be like Stone Cold, the Bionic Solomonster, a brace on each leg. Or a sleeve, whatever you want to call it. But anyway, when Rich talks about health and fitness and how it can make you happier, my point is, he is 100% right. So, this could be a podcast that you find really helpful. Definitely check them out. Also on the iTunes end, I just want to say thank you to the Elite Standard and Joseph Conlon. Thank you both for your 5 stars on iTunes. If you did not hear your name, don't worry. We've got more shout-outs coming up during the show. This was a good week, and I want to split them up a little bit, so we'll get to more shouts here in a little bit. Unfortunately, we had just got to kick things off with some sad news. I was very sad earlier in the week to hear about the death of former Ring of Honor champion Xavier this past week. John Bedoya, just 42 years old, the first Ring of Honor champion, I believe, to pass away. Of all the ROH champions that there have been, he wrestled on the very first Ring of Honor show back in 2002. Low Ki was a good friend of his. Low Ki was the very first Ring of Honor champion. Xavier beat him for it to become the second ever Ring of Honor world champion. He held that title for 6 months before dropping it to Samoa Joe, who would go on to, Joe went on to have over 600 plus days, his legendary run as the Ring of Honor World Champion, really the run that made him a star. And that ultimately led to him going to TNA. And also, that was really the run that made the championship. Joe's run didn't just help make Joe an established name, it established that championship as something coveted. For whatever reason, though, Xavier never really got a run in any of the major promotions, you know, on TV. He was big for a time on the independent scene. He had a few tryout matches over the years for WWE and for TNA. But that was it. He never got signed. It never went anywhere. By the time I got into Ring of Honor in 2006, I think it was 2006, and I started going to the live shows that summer, he was already out of the company. So I didn't really have a chance to see any of his title run. He did try his hand at MMA a number of years ago. He fought three amateur fights, never fought pro. Won his first fight by knockout, I think 14 seconds is what I saw. And then lost his next two fights by decision, and he had not fought since 2015. He had not wrestled a match in 4 years. And he was trying to make a comeback. He had got booked on a Ring of Honor show in March of this year. He was going to have a match against Jay Lethal, but then the pandemic hit and everything got canceled and all those plans got screwed up. So it just never worked out. It looked like he might have been trying to mount a comeback in ROH. Didn't work out. No word yet on cause of death. He had a lot of friends on the independent scene here in and around the New York area, I can tell you that. And so my condolences to all of them and his family and friends. So it's been a busy week of streaming. Again, we got one more big stream coming up tonight, and then there'll be an NXT stream on Wednesday night again on YouTube, because there's no AEW Dynamite on Wednesday. Dynamite is on Thursday this week, so you'll get me live on YouTube back-to-back nights. And there's another pay-per-view a week from today, believe it or not, WWE Payback, and we'll do a stream then as well. But last night I went 3 hours. We did the AEW Dynamite review, the NXT TakeOver, 30 review, and then took over an hour of phone calls. So it was a fun time last night. Let me just run through the key stuff from AEW last night. You can skip this part if you didn't see Dynamite yet. You don't want to be spoiled. But here's some of the key things that went down on TNT last night. The biggest thing of all being the main event between Cody and Brody Lee for the TNT Championship. We have a new TNT champion, and his name is Mr. Brody Lee. And they did a very heavy angle, injury angle, at the end of the show to not only put over Brody Lee, but really put over the entire Dark Order. And the match itself went 3 minutes. Cody did not mount a lick of offense. And this was their, I said last night, this was their version of 2014 SummerSlam between Brock Lesnar and John Cena. Brody Lee dominated the champion. He beat him from pillar to post, turned him inside out with the discus lariat, and pinned him. So that part of it was very surprising. They sold it like Cody had been mauled. He was hurt. They put a neck brace on him. They put him on a backboard. They put an oxygen mask on him. I thought that was a bit much. But they were really trying to sell this like he can be seriously hurt. And as they're carting him out, they grab Arn Anderson, does the Dark Order. They beat up Arn Anderson. Arn Anderson took some bumps. They laid him out. Cody was out. Brandy came out to check on her husband. Anna Jay, who was a member of the Dark Order, put Brandy to sleep in a sleeper hold, choked her out. The Dark Order had dragged out the members of the Nightmare family through the tunnel, out onto the stage. Dustin was dragged out. QT Marshall was dragged out. This was a heavy angle. I thought this was an outstanding show-closing angle. It kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting it. They beat WWE to the punch this weekend with the whole "you'll never see it coming" tagline. For a show overall that I thought was pretty good in terms of advancing things towards All Out. I wasn't really sold on a lot of the in-ring on the show at all. I mean, clearly NXT just blew it away in terms of in-ring. But that angle at the end really put that show over the top. And I am not the biggest Dark Order fan, but I can give props to what they're doing with them, because they're committed to the Dark Order. And Brody Lee is the leader of the Dark Order. If you want to see Brody Lee do well, you could not have booked that match and that angle last night any better than they did. Because for the first time since Brody Lee debuted back in March, he and the Dark Order both came off like a real threat. They both you know, they all came off like a bunch of badasses for the first time. Certainly more so than the retribution goofs that we see on WWE television. So I love the show closing angle. The only thing is, how many people saw it? Because they were out of their usual time slot, then the NBA delayed them by half an hour last night. They overlapped with the TakeOver show. I don't know what the final numbers are going to be. I guess we'll find out probably on Monday morning. Very curious to see how they did in that Saturday night slot against, you know, the competition. Tully Blanchard is the new manager of FTR. Again, kind of came out of left field. They've been hanging with Arn, and all of a sudden Tully takes over as their manager without much of an explanation. I like the pairing. It was just very odd for them to come on the air last night, and FTR's in the ring for a match with Private Party, and there's Tully in their corner as their new manager, has the new jacket on and everything. But later on in the show, he had said, "Fear the revelation," and somebody had tweeted me, I think, and drew the connection between the Book of Revelation and the Horsemen, and so that might have been a little Easter egg there. There's something going on. Obviously, there's a new group being formed, FTR, Tully. You know, is Arn going to be part of it? What about Cody? What about Hangman? We seem to be moving closer to an answer to these questions. So they're going to have a tag team gauntlet match coming up on Dynamite this Thursday, involving the Natural Nightmares, involving the Young Bucks, involving Best Friends, involving FTR. Whoever wins the gauntlet will challenge Kenny Omega and Hangman Page for the tag team titles at All Out. And already FTR is conspiring. They were talking to Hangman last night. Hangman was very upset about what they did to Ricky Morton in the Rock and Roll Express the week before, faking a knee injury, attacking them, spike pile driving Ricky Morton. And Dax Harwood just tried to explain, look, we had to just know who we can trust. And you're one of the only people who showed real concern when I hurt my knee a few weeks ago. And then he's trying to tell Hangman, you know, it really would be best if the Young Bucks don't win this gauntlet because then you're going to be in their shadow. So trying to set things up where maybe Hangman will cost the Young Bucks their match. The only thing I'll say is if they do the Young Bucks and FTR, if the gauntlet ends on Thursday with that being the match, I think that's ridiculous. I would not blow the first FTR Young Bucks match on a random Dynamite. So hopefully that, you know, that does not happen. Eddie Kingston. Here's something I can get behind. Eddie Kingston came out. There was a disagreement between the Lucha Bros and the Butcher and the Blade after they lost their 8-man tag team match to Jurassic Express. I think it was Jurassic Express and was it QT and Dustin? I didn't write down the other team. But in any event, they were arguing when the match was over. Eddie Kingston comes out and says, "What are you guys arguing about? You guys both should be tag team champions. Join with me. Join with me and I'll take you to the promised land." And there's a big group hug in the ring and Eddie Kingston looks into the camera with this devilish smile. And I said on the stream last night, it reminded me, and it wouldn't surprise me if they set this up this way on purpose, but it reminded me of when Bret Hart did this with Owen and Davey Boy. He reunited the family, he hugged them, and as he's hugging Owen and Davey Boy, and they're all crying, and Bret's looking off into the crowd at these dumb American fans that he had just turned heel on, and he's smirking. He's scheming. And that's the vibe I got from the way they shot this last night with Eddie Kingston. Eddie Kingston as the mouthpiece or the leader, the manager of a new group is 100% okay with me. So I love that idea. Ivelisse and Diamante won the Women's Tag Team Cup final. They beat Brandi and Allie, the Nightmare Sisters. And I think Ivelisse and Diamante would be a fine addition to whatever group Eddie Kingston is putting together. Get some female flavor in there. And Thunder Rosa, the NWA Women's Champion, the promo they inserted into the show. She's coming in to accept Hikaru Shida's challenge to a championship match. Not for the NWA Women's title, but for the AEW Women's title. At All Out. So they're at least bringing Thunder Rosa in for one match. I don't know if it's any kind of partnership with the NWA, but they're allowing her at least to come in and do the match, and that's awesome. Thunder Rosa is great, and I would love to see her as a new addition to the women's division in AEW. The future is very much up in the air right now as far as when the NWA is going to be able to run shows again. So Thunder Rosa against Shida at All Out, that's a good match. So that was an announcement I was not expecting last night. And I am all here for that. So those are the key things on Dynamite. Now we switch over to NXT. And some bittersweet news as far as Karrion Kross is concerned. On the one hand, Karrion Kross is the new NXT champion. He beat Keith Lee. Karrion Kross remains undefeated, and he is now the champion. But for how long? Because unfortunately for him, he got injured late in the match. Now, I didn't realize at first that he was injured. If you want to see my live reaction, because I was streaming live on YouTube, about to wrap up my review of NXT, and I started seeing people in the chat trying to get my attention, saying, Kross is hurt, Kross is hurt. And so live on the air, I went to investigate, and I saw that Triple H had said that he did get hurt. He separated his shoulder, and he was going to have an MRI done on Monday to find out the extent of the damage. So that sucks. And there's been other examples. I mentioned Brian Cage, Finn Balor, when he won the Universal title at SummerSlam a few years ago. Guys get their big moment, right? They're in their big moment. They win the championship, but they get hurt in the process. And in some cases, they have to then surrender the championship. Finn had to walk out in a sling on Raw the next night and give up the Universal title, and he has not sniffed that title since. And so here's Karrion Kross now. We don't know how bad the injury is, if he can gut through it. Maybe he'll be out a few weeks. Maybe it's worse. We don't know. Everyone was saying it happened on the Spirit Bomb. I don't think it happened on the Spirit Bomb. I went back and I watched, and it looks like where it happened was right before that. Keith Lee had come off the ropes with a clothesline or a shoulder tackle. It was some kind of move where he collided with Karrion Kross. As soon as Kross went down, he started gripping his shoulder. And that tells me that's where the injury first happened. Maybe it got a little worse as the match went on. He gutted it out. I mean, he wrestled another 5 minutes. He did the Saito side suplex on Keith Lee from the middle rope, which I'm sure did not feel too good upon landing. I was not a huge fan of the match or the finish, or the way the announcers called the finish, but it could just be a case of that's not the finish they were expecting. I mean, when was the last time we saw Karrion Kross win a match with the Saito suplex? I don't know that that was originally going to be the finish. So, good for him that he's the champion now, but for how long? Keith Lee, what do you do with Keith Lee? Now, if Karrion Kross is hurt, they may want to keep Keith Lee around anyway, but I'm thinking it's time to think about moving this guy over to Raw or SmackDown, with Raw being maybe the destination that makes more sense. You know, maybe Randy Orton wins the WWE Championship tonight. Keith Lee ends up being one of the new faces on Raw that maybe he can feud with. Randy Orton's had a lot of stuff to say about NXT. And NXT talents. So I could see that. I could see Randy Orton, one of his first programs or feuds in the months ahead, being with a big NXT name who gets called up. And Keith Lee might be that name. Pat McAfee. Pat McAfee impressed a lot of people last night in his match with Adam Cole. I wasn't completely shocked. I said Pat McAfee may surprise a lot of people. I don't know that I expected the match to be as good as it was. So he surprised even me in terms of how competent he looked at the ring. He didn't embarrass himself. He didn't really botch or flub anything. And he was also working in the ring with one of the best workers in the company. So that helps, right? If you would put Pat McAfee in the ring with the great Khali, I don't know. And that's a bad example because, I mean, not many people could get a good... Even Shawn Michaels could not get a good match out of the great Khali. Think about that. Not even the Heartbreak Kid himself could get a good match out of the great Khali. But it does help, I think, that he was in there with somebody the caliber of Adam Cole, and they had a very good match. Adam Cole's another one. Is he going to be moving on up? What is left for him in Undisputed Era to do in NXT? What is left for them to do? They're making room for the next generation of talent there, the Dexter Loomises of the world, the Damian Priests of the world, Bronson Reed, Cameron Grimes, right? All these different people. It's time to start thinking about who's moving up next. Is it Keith Lee? Is it Adam Cole? Is it both of them? You know, if it's both of them, don't put them on the same brand. Finn Balor's another one. Finn Balor beat Timothy Thatcher last night. How much longer is Finn Balor going to spend on the NXT roster? He's been back there for a year. And we're talking about the fact that if coming out of SummerSlam, The Fiend wins the title, or if Drew McIntyre retains, there's nobody. There's very few people on top of the card right now on Raw and SmackDown who you can kind of plug in there. They've got to bring back or bring up some of these people, even if they're not injected into the main event right away, start building them up for the fall and the winter. You got to start thinking ahead, looking beyond Thunderdome. I had to get that reference in. But they have to. You know, they got the Thunderdome through the end of October, and I'm going to talk about Thunderdome here in a second, but start looking beyond Thunderdome at what is coming after that. You're going to need some new faces. You're going to need some new names, some new contenders. Damian Priest won the North American Championship ladder match. He is the new champion. That was a spectacle of a match. I'm shocked that Karrion Kross was the only injury I heard about coming out of the show. There was a spot with Cameron Grimes where he got, I think it was a sunset powerbomb onto a ladder, and he just clipped it, like the side of the ladder. How these guys, and Velveteen Dream took a header off the ladder down through a table that was off camera. These guys were killing each other. It's a car crash. And we had an excellent women's title match, Io Shirai retaining over Dakota Kai. Rhea Ripley was out after to kind of stare down Raquel Gonzalez, but then she was staring at Io from afar. She wants that NXT Women's Championship. And one last note here. There was a spot in the women's title match where Io did a moonsault out onto the floor onto Dakota and Raquel. And she landed right, it looked like her knees anyway, caught Raquel right on top of her skull. And Raquel is okay, but it was a very scary spot. And on the stream last night, I said it reminded me of the spot from TNA many years ago with Zema Ion, right now Joaquin Wilde in Legado del Fantasma. But at the time, he was Zema Ion and Jesse Sorensen, who was a young star, former football player on the rise in the company. He got hurt. He got paralyzed. Thankfully, he recovered. He regained all of his faculties. But his wrestling career basically fizzled out after that. And it's just a pure coincidence. I happened to bring up Jesse Sorensen last night, and I got an email this morning from Ace, shout out to Ace Shock, who sent me a link to this week's AEW Dark from this past Tuesday, and the opening match on the show, what happens to be the opening match? It's supposed to be a handicap match, John Cruz and Jesse Sorensen against the Murderhawk monster Lance Archer. Now, I don't know if that was Jesse Sorensen's first appearance on Dark or if he's made other appearances before, but that's a little eerie even for me, that he just so happened to be on this week's AEW Dark. I mean, I pulled that name out of my ass last night when I was given that example. I didn't expect to be talking about that, and apparently Jesse Sorensen is still around and still wrestling, and I don't know, maybe he's looking for his next shot in AEW. I don't know. Now, AEW has beaten WWE to the punch in bringing live fans back into the buildings. Oh, this is not going to go over well with Vince McMahon. All that money and hype for the Thunderdome with virtual fans, and now AEW is bringing back actual flesh and blood fans into the buildings. It will not be long before WWE follows suit. I don't know that they're allowed to have fans in the building as part of this deal with the Amway Center, but believe me, when that deal is over, if you don't think that they're going to try, that they're not going to try to bring fans back into the building if AEW is doing it, then you haven't been paying attention. It's only a matter of time. Daly's Place is an outdoor venue. I guess that's a little bit safer, I guess. It's still kind of enclosed. It's not, I mean, it is open air, but it's not like a stadium where it's totally open air. I think it's still a dumb risk to take just to go to a wrestling show. I'm sorry. That's my opinion. I know New Japan has been allowing a low capacity number of fans into the buildings. New Japan has had some shows with upwards of 3,000 people spread out throughout the building. The situation over in Japan, though, is a little bit different than it is here in this country. Although it sounds like that might be changing. I guess cases are on the rise again in Japan, and would not shock me to see that New Japan and other promotions either shut down completely again or at least shut people out of the buildings if it gets to that point. But starting with Dynamite this Thursday, they are going to be allowing select fans into Daly's Place at 10% capacity. The idea is that if that goes well, they may expand it up to 15% for future shows. So that works out to be about 700 or 750 or so fans max to start with and see how that goes. Fans are going to be physically distanced. Tickets will be sold in seating pods in groups of 2, 3, 4, and 6 to accommodate families and groups of friends who show up and want to sit together and know each other. They'll be up in the 200 level section. So that's kind of like the upper deck or, you know, upper, whatever, mezzanine level, whatever level that is at Daly's Place. They'll leave a section below that completely empty. And then down below on the ground level is where the wrestlers will be and the show will be taking place. Fans are going to be required to wear masks, temperatures taken at the door, any merch, food, beverage purchases will all be cashless transactions. So credit card only or Apple Pay or however it is that you want to pay for your shit. Tony Khan issued an open letter talking about people buying and reselling tickets. They're already seeing people buying and reselling tickets on the secondary market, which defeats the entire purpose of keeping the people who show up together and who know each other in a pod together. This is what he said. He said, the tickets were sold in groups or pods with the intention of keeping fans with their friends and families and safely distanced from other fans in attendance. We're seeing some of these tickets being sold on the secondary market in a way that splits the original pod and therefore potentially combines two or more groups of unacquainted fans in the same pod. This was clearly not our intention. Nothing is more important than the health and well-being of the entire AEW family, and that certainly includes our fans. It's an illegal, unethical, and inappropriate move by the secondary market sellers, and we intend to police this situation online as well as the venue. To that end, we are asking our fans to inform us if they are or if they feel that they have purchased tickets that were originally part of a larger pod, and we will do what we can to offer a remedy. Furthermore, we will be watching for any AEW Dynamite tickets on the secondary market, and if we see anyone trying to divide a pod for resale, we will cancel the entire original order. I went on one of those reseller sites just to take a look, and I found examples of scalpers buying up all the tickets to a single pod and then selling maybe 2 tickets or 3 tickets to a pod of 6, which is fucking disgusting. And those tickets should be immediately invalidated. And if I do see anything like that, I will let AEW know. Those tickets should immediately be invalidated. The people who do this are scum. Let's be clear. The people who do this are scum. Absolute, deadbeat, piece of crap scumbags who deserve to have the book thrown at them. Among other things, thrown at them. And if Ticketmaster is not going to fix this and AEW is not able to control it, if it's kind of getting out of control, they don't really have a good remedy for it, then they need to cancel all of the tickets and end the experiment. You know, I can appreciate that they're trying to keep people contained and distanced in these pods. I don't think it's a bad idea if you're going to do it to try it that way. And it's good to hear from Tony Khan directly that they're aware of the problem and they're trying to address it. I'm happy to hear that. You know, they're at least trying to put precautions in place, and these scumbags are reselling these tickets. They don't give a shit. Yeah, they don't give a fuck. The way they're setting this up, again, is not bad if they're going to run shows with fans. It's the only way to do it, frankly. But if they can't stop this from happening, then they need to come up with a better system or they need to just drop it altogether. And you know what? I'm going to give WWE credit. Say what you want to about the virtual fans. And I will, here in a second. It is still safer than bringing people back into the buildings. So you know what? I give them credit for that. I give WWE in this instance credit for that. But again, if AEW cannot get the situation fixed, if they try and there's still resellers who are just going to do whatever they're going to do and they're going to split the tickets, then you can't do this. You can't put a statement out saying you care about the safety and the well-being of the fans and then you have these assholes on the secondary market splitting pods and then just don't do anything about it. Because then you're full of shit. So hopefully they're able to police this and fix this, and if not, then they have to end this. So let's talk SummerSlam, because SummerSlam is tonight. You'll never see it coming. That is the tagline for SummerSlam. I only have one change in my predictions from Thursday. So I'm sticking to pretty much all of my predictions except one that I have made a change to in light of stuff that has happened since then on SmackDown. The Mandy Rose Sonya Deville situation, it is now no disqualification, with the loser being forced to leave WWE. And so a lot of people think it's just designed that way for Sonya Deville to take time off after the incident at her home last weekend. My original prediction from Thursday, though, still works, and I'm sticking with my prediction. Instead of Sonya winning the match and shaving Mandy's head until Otis comes out, this was the idea that I pitched a few days ago. Sonya wins, because a lot of people are probably expecting or were expecting Mandy to win, because she already got her hair cut. So of course Mandy's going to win. Well, what if she doesn't? What if Sonya wins? And right before she's about to finish the job and shave Mandy bald, which will never happen, Otis comes out and tries to save Mandy by offering his Money in the Bank briefcase to Sonya if she agrees not to shave Mandy's head bald. And Mandy says, I'll take your offer. And she takes the briefcase, and Sonya Deville now owns the Money in the Bank briefcase, because Otis ain't winning shit. Otis is not going to be WWE champion. Otis is not going to be Universal champion. Otis cashing in for the tag team titles would be dumb. If you think this idea is dumb, then that's every bit as dumb. So it's not as if Otis having the briefcase is going to amount to anything in the end anyway. At least here it plays into his love for his beautiful peach. So Sonya gets the win, and she gets the briefcase. And Mandy gets to keep her hair. That was the original idea that I pitched the other day. And in this case, her career is on the line. Sonya wins, Mandy's out of the company until Otis comes out. And the same idea can still work. He can offer the briefcase. If you agree to let Mandy stay, reinstate her, whatever, you can have my Money in the Bank briefcase. And Mandy says, Otis, no, you can't do this. But he's a dumb babyface blinded by love. And people do dumb things when they're blinded by love. And Sonya gets the briefcase. So you kind of get to the same point either way. Apollo Crews retains over MVP. That's my prediction there. Cedric Alexander is going heel. I don't think it happens tonight. Maybe at Payback next Sunday, but not tonight. But they've got to keep the belt on Apollo so that they can get to the U.S. title match against Lashley. Again, maybe next Sunday. And then you can do a title change and Bobby Lashley becomes the new United States champion. But he's got to keep the belt tonight in order to get there. Street Profits, I have them retaining over Angel Garza and Andrade. They had a beat the clock challenge on Friday night involving Sasha and Bayley each having to wrestle Naomi. And it will now be Bayley up first defending her SmackDown Women's Championship against Asuka tonight. Sasha Banks gets the second match with Asuka. So that changes things a little bit from the way that I laid it out on the prediction stream. But same logic still works. I'm not changing my predictions here. Asuka beats Bayley. Instead of Asuka beating Sasha first and winning the Raw Women's title, Asuka beats Bayley and becomes the SmackDown Women's Champion. Sasha tries to help, it backfires. Later in the night, Asuka beats Sasha to win back the Raw Women's title, when Bayley comes out and basically repays the favor. Things are breaking down between Sasha Banks and Bayley, and Asuka is the beneficiary. She is now Asuka Two Belts. But I hate people having two belts, so let's fix this. Asuka becomes Asuka Two Belts, out comes Shayna Baszler. I said, I know she's got something going on with Nia Jax. Fuck the Nia Jax, Shayna Baszler stuff. Shayna Baszler had told Asuka a few weeks ago, I want you to win the Raw Women's title, because when you do, I am coming for you. And she doesn't waste any time. As soon as Asuka wins the championship, she's celebrating two belts. Here comes Shayna Baszler. Puts her in the Kirifuda clutch, puts Asuka out, sends a message to her. And that brings out Sonya Deville, who comes out and cashes in her Money in the Bank on Asuka. Now, she's a SmackDown star, so she's not doing it for the Raw title, but she wins the SmackDown. She's cashing in for the SmackDown Women's Championship. So that takes care of the problem of how you're going to have Asuka as a Raw star being the SmackDown Women's Champion. You're not. Asuka's the Raw Women's Champion. Sonya Deville is now the new SmackDown Women's Champion. And I love the idea because, again, it accomplishes at least four different things in this scenario, right? Between putting Sonya in a prime position, furthering the split between Sasha and Bayley, ending the two belts bullshit, just establishing things with Asuka and Shayna. So many different things are accomplished by doing it this way. Even if you don't like the idea, you got to admit it accomplishes a few different things. At least it is a productive finish. So I'm sticking with my prediction. And look, I may be out there, I may be wrong, but I'm sticking to my guns on this. Seth Rollins, I have him getting the win over Dominic. We're going to get to see Dominic Mysterio for the first time ever in a one-on-one match. I've been impressed when I've seen him, you know, physically out there doing certain things in the ring. He seems very capable. You know, Pat McAfee opened a lot of eyes and impressed a lot of people last night. Tonight is Dominic's turn. But I don't see him winning this match. But you know what? This could be to SummerSlam 2020 what the Love Her or Leave Her match was with Shane McMahon and Test at SummerSlam 1999, which is actually one of my favorite SummerSlam matches. The only difference is that match had a hot crowd. But that was a shockingly good match. And like I said, one of my favorite SummerSlam matches. I did not see coming. This could be to this year's SummerSlam what that match was to that year's SummerSlam. The tag team match is going to happen between, you know, Rey and Dominic against Rollins and Murphy. It's just a matter of when. You know, again, Rollins, I think, wins here, but that leads into the tag team match. And then we have Braun Strowman and The Fiend. Bray Wyatt for the Universal Championship. And I had Strowman retaining. I had him retaining over The Fiend. This match has now been announced as a Falls Count Anywhere match. This was added after SmackDown on Friday night. This is now Falls Count Anywhere in the building. That is the same stipulation that they used when The Fiend won the championship the first time last year in Saudi Arabia. So this is the match where I am changing my prediction. I had Braun Strowman retaining the championship, the big setup with him and Alexa, you know, kind of trapping The Fiend. I'm changing my prediction. I had Strowman retaining with the setup. I still think it could be a setup, by the way. Doesn't mean that it still can't be a setup with Braun, who ends up not going heel. It was a ruse with him and Alexa working together. That could still happen. But I think Nikki Cross is going to foil their plan and get involved in this. And this leads to The Fiend beating Braun Strowman and regaining the Universal Championship, which he should. He should win the title. And so that is the one change in my predictions that I am making here. I think The Fiend walks out with the belt, and it is Nikki Cross, who may be the real story coming out of this match. And then I got Drew McIntyre losing to Randy Orton. I have Randy Orton winning his 14th WWE Championship. I really hope that the big swerve here is not Ric Flair coming back and giving Drew a low blow. To me, that would be predictable and lame. Keep Ric Flair off of television. He had a great send-off with that promo and, you know, being put down by Orton. We don't need the swerve involving 71-year-old Ric Flair. Please, for the love of God, you can do better than that. But I think Orton's walking away with the belt. I just think there's more potential challengers waiting in line for him than there are for Drew McIntyre, and McIntyre could always fight to claw himself back. The chase, right? The money in the chase and all that. I don't think there's money in anything, any chase right now. I mean, the only money in WWE is in all these, you know, established TV contracts and the Saudi Arabia deal. That's where the big money is. Right now, with no crowds, ratings plummeting every week. I don't think there's any money in any chase right now in this company. But I'm going to be doing the WrestleRumble.com contest tonight, which I'm looking forward to. I hope you all join. If you're not signed up, it's only a buck. So go to WrestleRumble.com. It's winner take all, draped in gold. Draped in gold, you can win 5 classic WWE Championship belts, including a mystery belt that I will reveal live on YouTube tonight. I'm going to be drawing the random winner. And you will find out live on the air if you are a winner, and your belts will be shipped out to you via FedEx tomorrow morning, courtesy of WrestleRumble.com. So head on over. It's only a dollar, and you can enter as many times as you want. They're also doing a SummerSlam Pick'em contest on WrestleRumble.com that is separate from the one that I am hosting for them live tonight. That one you can enter as well on their website. That one is winner take all, where you get a Winged Eagle championship and $500 cash. So you might want to enter that contest as well. Some more quick shouts for our PayPal army, Raymond the Mountie Medina. Thank you for your support. Raymond's been one of our long times. Ryan the Dagger McTaggart. I hope he and the family are doing well. Money Maxwell and the whole gang. Project Zero Mortals, Wayne Ishanti. The Chicago Slayer, Willie. Oh, the Chicago Slayer. I always mix these two up. We got to put you guys against each other. I'm going to have to start pitting PayPal people against each other in like a fight to the death. You got the Chicago Slayer. We have the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelot. Eric Blood and Guts Bamford. Ostentatious Alan Carter, Rockhard Russell Segee, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, The Firebomber Craig Foster, Eric First Blood Fisher, The Guardian Angel Jacob Donnelly, Powerful Pierre Degagne, The Queen City Saint Pablo Pablissimo, Night Stalker Naef Al Safar, and Eric Gimp Mode Erickson. Another first-time donator, so welcome aboard, Eric. And one last shout here for Dean the Mighty Mo Mowbray. You have heard me talk about Dean before, if that name sounds familiar. Dean has an online store. You can find it at etsy.com/shop/scenescapeshop. All one word, scenescape shop. He does various WWE paintings. He's getting better at it every month. I think that go take a look at them yourself. They're very good. He's got some new ones up now for Bret Hart, The Fiend, The Demon, Stone Cold, The Rock. He's got others too. It's not just wrestling. He's got film ones, TV paintings, landscapes, all sorts of things. All sorts of paintings. He also has a Patreon page now, patreon.com/scenescapeshop. And for $5 a month, he'll send you your choice of a print from his store as a thank you. And for as long as you pledge your support on there, you get one free painting every other month. So that's half a dozen paintings for free each year. And as another perk, you get 25% off all prints from his Etsy store. So check him out, etsy.com/shop/scenescapeshop. And on Patreon at patreon.com/scenescapeshop. I only had the chance briefly the other night on the prediction stream to address the Sonya Deville story, which has seen some developments in the days since then. This all happened, you know, I did not have a chance to talk about this, even though it happened last weekend, technically the morning that I went to record 665. So I just wasn't able to talk about it until now. But, you know, we hear about stans, I hate that fucking word, but we hear about stans all the time, right? These stalkerish, obsessed fans that a lot of these wrestlers and celebrities have online. Athletes, wrestlers, they all have them. They have stans. These obsessed fans who follow their every move, their every tweet. They use their image as their avatar online. They can do no wrong. These people can do no wrong. If you say the one cross word about them, the army comes out. It is an unhealthy obsession that a lot of these people has. One thing between being a fan of somebody, which is fine, and just taking it way over the line. And people make fun of them, and you don't really think anything of it because usually they're harmless. You know, you might argue back and forth online or something, but usually they're harmless. But there is a small subset of these people who are not harmless and who occasionally you get stories like what happened last weekend. A man who I am not going to name because he doesn't deserve the attention, who had been stalking Sonya Deville on social media for months, going back, I believe, to March of 2019. So last year, early last year. Is as far back as she has been able to trace the messages from him. He had been stalking her that whole time. He drove last weekend from South Carolina to her home in Florida. He found her address. He drove to her home, which was not something he did on an impulse. He had been planning this out, he said, for 8 months. He was planning this for 8 months. He had planned to kidnap and have sex with Sonya Deville. He sent her an Instagram message when he got there telling her, hey, look outside by your pool. I'm here and I'm going to, and this is what he said. He goes, and quote, I'm going to kill that little bitch you have inside with you. And that little bitch he was referring to was Mandy Rose, who was staying over Sonya's house and sleeping in her guest room. And Sonya was not aware of any of these messages, these, I guess, dozens of messages or hundreds of messages that he had been sending her on Instagram, because I'm sure all these celebrities and WWE people, they have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands or even, in some cases, a few million followers. And if people are messaging you, there's no way you're going to read every single message. It's just not possible. So only after the fact did she kind of jump in there and realize this guy's been messaging me, including outside my own freaking home. She was not aware of any of these messages. She only knew that he was out there because her home alarm system went off. And thank God she had one of those. Now that's bad enough. But what makes this even creepier is that he had cut a hole in her patio screen. And he was standing outside of her home for 4 hours watching the two of them inside. I guess they were watching TV. There was one report that said maybe they were watching the UFC pay-per-view on Saturday night. He cut a hole in the screen and was watching and eavesdropping on their conversation for 4 hours. And an hour after they went to bed, it's 2 o'clock in the morning now, he sets off the alarm. He trips up the alarm. Now, I watched the security camera footage. I'm sure some of you did as well because it has been posted online in some of these news reports. There's no audio. It's very brief, but it is the security camera footage. And in the footage, you can see Sonya walk out through her kitchen. She opens the door. I don't know if it was the patio door or what it was, but she opens the door to see what's going on. She looks out and she sees a man outside standing there. Now, we can't see the guy outside, but she sees him. She said he was only maybe 4 feet away. And she shouts, "What are you doing?" And he didn't say anything, and instead he started walking towards her. And that's when she knew, he's not here to rob me, he's here to hurt me. Now, she had already woken up Mandy. I guess when she got up out of her room, she woke up Mandy, then she went to go see what was going on. So Mandy was already woken up, which is good, because Sonya came back into the house. She speed walks back into the house and tells Mandy, there's a guy in the house, we gotta get the hell out of here. She grabs her car keys and they make a dash for the garage. Now, in the video, you see the guy walk into the house. That's the last shot in the video. After Sonya has already taken off, it's not even 5 seconds later, the guy is in her kitchen. This creepy SOB is in this woman's house. And Sonya, when she was testifying, because she had to go to court, she was giving her testimony about what happened. There's video of that as well. She said that he must have thought that they ran upstairs. He thought they ran upstairs and were hiding. So that's where he went. He didn't realize that they had gone through into the garage. Otherwise, he would have followed them into the garage. And who knows what would have happened at that point if they didn't get the car started, you know, right away. This could have gone sideways so many different ways. And I know a lot of people said Sonya Deville is really tough and she's got fight experience. I mean, the woman has a 2-1 MMA record. I mean, she has literally fought fights before. I'm sure she's a tough lady. Even still, the guy had a knife on him. A knife and a gun. These are the great equalizers here, okay? Doesn't matter how tough you think you are. If the person is armed, if they have weapons, then you're not going to be able to do much against that. He had a knife. He had a backpack. In the backpack was mace, zip ties, duct tape, and a single condom. And he told cops that his plan was to take her hostage by macing her, binding her hands with the zip ties, wrapping duct tape around her arms to restrain her. And he was not going to leave until she answered all of his questions because he was upset that she had been ignoring him. This nut job sent this woman hundreds of messages threatening to rape her, which I guess is what the condom was for. She testified that she found messages from him demanding that she have sex with him. He threatened her mother. He threatened her sister. He threatened her niece. He threatened to decapitate her ex-girlfriend, which spooked the ex-girlfriend so much that the ex-girlfriend deactivated her Instagram account. So he's been charged with aggravated stalking, armed burglary, attempted armed kidnapping, and criminal mischief. They assigned a public defender to him because he has no money. Shocking. So they assigned a public defender to him who argued that he should be released on bail for $2 million, which he cannot afford. And he should have an ankle bracelet or some kind of electronic monitoring device put on him. Thankfully, common sense prevailed here. Sanity prevailed. I feel like the first time that's happened in the state of Florida in a while. Sanity prevailed, and the judge denied his bail request, ordered him to remain in custody pending trial. So for now, he's locked up where he belongs. He is a menace to not only this woman, but other people as well. I mean, this is a guy who... He also threatened to kill her neighbors, I guess, to prove some kind of point to her. So not only has he threatened violence against her, he has threatened violence against multiple people. And he has shown that he will act on these impulses. So he belongs in a cage until trial. He should not be allowed on the street. He should not be allowed to walk amongst all of the other people that are out there. You cannot let somebody like this out. End of story. Can you imagine, put yourself in Sonya Deville's shoes, if they gave this guy bail? Obsessed as he is, all he's going to be thinking about is, how can I get to this woman? How can I kill this woman? And imagine, you got to be out there, traveling back and forth, you know, going to work every night. You got to worry about that. Imagine if they let this guy out. So it was the only scenario that made sense. Remand him into custody until trial, which is what they did. But I know in The Observer, Meltzer had mentioned that some of the other WWE talents in the days since the incident have applied for gun licenses in their respective states. Some of them are installing new home security systems, which is a must. I mean, look, if you're a celebrity and you're on TV, you need to have a home alarm or you need to have some kind of a security system. Even more so if you have a family, but even if you don't have a family, you want to protect yourself, you've got to have some kind of security system. It's completely foolish not to. There are some very sick individuals out there. And another thing that they can do, and this goes for anybody, if you have any kind of problem like this, is to make sure you archive. Pay attention to the messages you get and make sure that you archive and keep a record of every single thing and report them. Don't take any chances, because the reality is, you just never know. You just never know. This is the world that we live in. This is not just a wrestling fan problem. Oh, it makes wrestling fans look like basement dwellers. It does. But don't you think that there are people like this out there who obsess over football players and baseball players and movie stars? John Lennon's been dead for 40 years because of an obsessed fan. We had an American president shot and almost assassinated by a psycho who was trying to impress Jodie Foster. You can even look a few years ago, Christina Grimmie. You talk about a sad story. What a tragedy that was. 22-year-old singer shot dead by a, quote, fan. Yeah, some fan. Shot and killed her. Some of these people are just sick in the head, and some of these people are just plain bad people. And the stories that I hear about women's wrestlers especially, and the messages that they get online, it's sickening. And I hope that they make an example out of this clown, and hopefully Sonya can put this behind her. I'm sure it was a traumatic thing. You know, look, I gave my prediction earlier about what I think is going to happen tonight at SummerSlam. It could be that, you know, they changed the stipulation because she is going to take some time off. And if she wants to take time off, then by all means, she deserves to take time off. Take all the time you need. I don't know that that's why they changed the stipulation. That's why I'm sticking to my prediction. But, you know, you go through an experience like that, it messes with your head. You know, they caught the guy and he's in custody and all that, but you don't just forget about that. You don't just turn that off. You talk about the ultimate invasion of privacy. That is a traumatic experience for anyone to go through. And I'm just glad that it ended the way it did, because this could have ended in tragedy. WWE has left the Performance Center in Orlando for the Amway Center in Orlando. So they have not ventured very far. But they are in Amway now. They kicked off the Thunderdome era of SmackDown on Friday night. It was the brand new Hollywood Squares edition of SmackDown. And it got them some curiosity viewers. They were back over 2 million overnight viewers in the ratings for the first time in weeks. 2.1 million viewers. And if they have a really good hook coming out of SummerSlam tonight, maybe they'll get a pay-per-view bump. On Monday night, maybe they'll get a pay-per-view bump on Fox on Friday, which they'll need because they have another pay-per-view coming up in 7 days. John Alba reported that WWE is paying the city of Orlando, which owns the Amway Center, $450,000 to rent out the building through October 30th, which does not sound like a bad deal. That's probably what they would usually pay for a couple of TV tapings at various arenas. Not 2 months worth of taping, so that sounds like a good deal, I guess. Nearly 1,000 LED video boards installed all around the ringside area. Pyro, lasers, they love their lasers. Drone cameras, we were told. I didn't really see any drone shots, maybe I missed them. Kevin Dunn had given an interview about Thunderdome. We don't really hear from Kevin Dunn too much. He stays in... he's usually busy logging. But, logging work hours, of course. That's what I mean. But Kevin Dunn said that it would be, quote, a big, beautiful entrance, bigger than WrestleMania. Which I guess is true if he's referring to this year's WrestleMania only. Now, if he was referring to WrestleMania in general when he said that, then he's an idiot. So they started with this virtual fan experiment on Thursday. I signed up for shits and giggles, and I got the email from WWE giving me a link, telling me that I could come into the Thunderdome. And I said, all right, let's give this thing a shot. And I tried it, and I got in, and I was waiting in queue. And again, they were just doing some test matches on Thursday. So I'm sitting here, and I'm ready to go. And all I see, they're playing this video package that's about WWE and celebrity involvement, and they just keep replaying the package over and over and over again. And so after 25 minutes or however long I was sitting here like an idiot, I said, the hell with this. I got bored and I went to go eat dinner. And then I think the test started a few minutes later, but I didn't give a shit. I said to Noah, was trying the same thing. I said to Noah, I called him, I said, hey, you're in the Thunderdome, right? He goes, yeah, I'm waiting. I go, good, you'll tell me how it is. I go, if you ask me, do I care more about Thunderdome or do I care more about eating? I care more about eating. I'm sorry. So I went and had dinner. But look, here's the thing. They had to try something. They were dying a death at the PC. The PC, thank God they had the PC. They should be thanking their lucky stars that they have that PC lease, which I assume, they must have renewed. Last I heard, the lease on the PC was ending in November, but I'm sure they're going to renew it if they haven't already. So they're very lucky they had a performance center. But after months and months and months of being at the performance center, like any other place, really, you get bored. And it's worse when you don't have fans. Now, you may not have fans elsewhere, but at least get into a different setting, get into an outdoor setting. I thought maybe they would do something fun like that for SummerSlam. No fans, but like an outdoor venue, by the beach or something. And they didn't do that. Instead, they said, we're going to do Thunderdome. And so it's something new for them to try. My first impressions, here are the positives. It's a good visual, so long as it's not the hard camera view. I think it looks terrible on the hard camera view. It doesn't look so bad on the other camera angles, like from the side. And it is nice to be back in an arena setting and have pyro. And look, the pyro itself, who gives a shit? But just the idea that we have it now, it felt like more of a normal WWE event, at least in certain moments, if you just kind of forgot about the virtual people on the screens and just tried not to pay too much attention to it, it did kind of feel like, okay, we're back in more of a normal setting, kind of. It does give it more of a big show feel. Now you can do the big entrances where they come out and you don't see the ceiling fan and, they have all the pomp and circumstance and all that. Now the negatives. There is an obvious lag or delay in reaction times because whenever something would happen or there was a big move or a big match finish, the people in the boxes on the screens didn't react, or their reaction was delayed by like 10 seconds. Now, that could be to give them a delay to boot people if they do something they shouldn't be doing, if they act stupid on camera. I don't know, but I also saw at least one guy falling asleep when they zoomed in. He had his eyes closed, like he was in deep REM sleep. At the end of the Jeff Hardy match, it looked like they reacted right away, though. So maybe they got things fixed by the end, I don't know. But for everything else, it just looked like they were just sitting there bored out of their minds. Now, that's not necessarily very different than the WWE events that we were having even before the pandemic. But it really hits home when you see these people and they're just not reacting. They had multiple boxes with the same faces. Unless these people all have identical twins who happen to all get into the Thunderdome, they gotta fix that. The canned crowd noise was awful. It literally sounds like they're using crowd reaction noises from the video games. It sounds like something out of the 2K video games. But I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt here. This was only the first night. This was night one. Tonight is going to be night two. It's going to take a while to work out the kinks. It's a work in progress. Hopefully they'll address some of these issues as best they can. But it has its pros and cons. At the end of the day, all of the bells and whistles in the world will not mean shit if these shows don't improve and get better. It's the lipstick on a pig analogy. You can dress it up any way you want to. It's still a pig. Jon Moxley, the AEW champion, did an interview on the Observer website, and I thought he perfectly summed up what I have been saying about the Thunderdome stuff. He said, "We know what their problem is. It's one person, three letters, VKM. That's the problem until he is gone or he relinquishes control. Until then, it is not going to change. When I watch the show during the pandemic era, I'm just like, oh, thank God I'm not there. Jesus Christ, like, what would I be doing on that show right now? Can you imagine? You think it would be any good? Come on, I really don't want to get into bashing them, but all the LED boards and shit in their Thunderdome is not going to fix their problems. We know what the problem is." And I've been saying it for years. Moxley is dead on 100% correct. I know some people are going to go, oh, there he goes again. Jon Moxley biting the hand that fed him, bashing WWE, it's getting old. He's got a right to talk about Thunderdome. He checked it out. And he gave his opinion on it. And it just so happens that in this case, his opinion is dead on 100% correct. I mean, would you deny it? Even if you like Thunderdome. You can like Thunderdome, but still accept the fact that it has no bearing at the end of the day here on the creative aspect of the company and the stories and the people they push and what we are seeing on TV. That is still the most important thing. Even if you liked Thunderdome, you got to admit that. He's not wrong. They play to an audience of one. And until something changes and they get on a good roll creatively, all the LED boards and all the lasers in the world are not going to make this show suddenly great again. Now, there was a report this week from Alex McCarthy of Sports Keita, the same Alex McCarthy from TalkSport in the UK. And he said that Vince McMahon, he heard from one source in the company. There's just one person that he spoke with that Vince McMahon is at least considering the idea. People are talking about this like it's a done deal. People don't pay attention. These people's problem is that they go to websites or podcasts, they're being misinformed. Let me properly inform you. No, Shane McMahon is not now heading Monday Night Raw. That is not true. The report is that Vince McMahon is considering putting Shane McMahon in charge in some way, creatively, on Monday Night Raw. Especially because Bruce Pritchard is looking to lessen his workload. He's got a lot on his plate. He's still doing the podcast with Conrad. I mean, I'm sure the hours that he has to spend working for Vince McMahon, I'm surprised he's even still doing the podcast. If I'm Bruce Pritchard at this point, I'm just telling Conrad, just do all the work, you do all the research, just spit things out and I'll just say, yeah, I remember that, or nah, I don't really remember that, and just cash the check. You know, I mean, really, there's only so many hours in the day. I haven't listened to the show lately with Conrad and Bruce. I don't know if it's fallen off or not. I know some people still listen to it. Some people still enjoy it. But if Shane McMahon has new ideas to offer and Raw Underground has hardly been some kind of big home run, if that was his idea, I've heard conflicting stories about whose idea that was. If Shane has some new ideas that he brings to the table, then great. But how long before we hear that he's burned out again working for his father and he either quits or he gets reassigned? How many times are we going to hear the same story? Why do people fall for this? Why do people fall for this and think that things are going to be radically different? We had Paul Heyman. Last year it was Paul Heyman and Eric Bischoff. Over the years, it's been other people they've brought in. Now it's going to be Shane McMahon, possibly. What makes you think this is going to just change anything or be any different? This guy literally walked out of the company. He decided to leave the company, his family-owned company. He left because he could not take it anymore. He could not handle the verbal abuse and the bullshit from his father, and he said, peace out. And he was gone for 7 years. How long, if Shane gets put in that role, how long before Shane gets burned out or the axe falls on Shane? So back to Thunderdome. Not only will SummerSlam tonight be held at the Amway Center, Payback next Sunday will, and we have Clash of Champions on September 27th. Surprisingly, there is nothing on the schedule for the month of October. Originally, there was going to be a show on October 18th. I guess due to COVID, plans have changed since they're not going to be in whatever city they were going to be in that night. So instead, the next show is going to be November 1st. So we go from September 27th to November 1st for Hell in a Cell, which they have to do outside the PC. You cannot do Hell in a Cell at the Performance Center. I mean, physically, you might be able to fit it in there. You can't do it, though. You cannot do Hell in a Cell in the Performance Center. You can't do it. Even if they don't extend the deal with Amway, which ends at the end of October, they got to go somewhere else if they're going to do Hell in a Cell. It just doesn't work inside the PC. So that's November 1st, and then a few weeks later on November 22nd is the Survivor Series. And then December 20th for TLC. So those are the dates coming up. Mark them down if you wanted to know what the pay-per-view schedule is going to be. And if you want to register to be part of Thunderdome, if you want to give it a shot, you can do so. WWEThunderdome.com. You can sign up. I assume all the slots for tonight are taken up, but maybe for Raw, for SmackDown, and see if you can get in there. One of the boxes on the screen on SmackDown Friday night, he was in like the first two rows, was a bear. They had a teddy bear who was on camera for all of or most of SmackDown on Friday night. So we had the bear. You know, maybe this week we'll have a rhinoceros, a kangaroo, you know, some other kind of mammal. People can get creative with it. I just hope they don't do what they were doing in like the UK. I guess they tried this with like some soccer games overseas or football. I guess over there it's called football. And there were people, you know, with the virtual fan stuff who were putting pictures of, like, Osama bin Laden and Pol Pot and Mussolini. It's like, you're talking about Murderer's Row. I mean, we don't need that. Hopefully they'll cut that off before that happens. But, yeah, maybe we'll see the bear back on TV tonight. So I'll talk more about SmackDown in a few minutes. The other big story this week, first reported by the website OutKick.com, Renee Young is leaving WWE. She gave her notice this past week before last. She gave notice to the company. She herself has not commented publicly on this yet, but it seems all but confirmed from a whole bunch of different sources now. I mean, first Kathy Kelly leaves, and now Renee. These people are jumping ship. They want out. And really, with Renee, can you blame her? They took talking smack away from her, only to bring it back yesterday, with Kayla Braxton as the host. Now, I know Renee is leaving, so it wouldn't make any sense to make her the host again if she's already said that she's leaving. Make her the host, you know, for talking smack. But that's hilarious to me. I'm sorry. She was really upset, too, at the time when they canceled Talking Smack. A lot of people were. It was actually a good show. I haven't watched any of Raw Talk, so I can't speak to whether or not Raw Talk is as good as Talking Smack used to be. But they just brought it back. It is on the free and the paid tier. of WWE Network. I guess on Saturday mornings is when they're going to upload it, Friday night, Saturday morning. It's going to be Kayla Braxton and Xavier Woods hosting going forward. Woods missed the first show. This was hilarious. So they advertised that Xavier Woods is going to be the new co-host of Talking Smack, and the very first episode, he's not on the show. The Miz took his place. I guess because I think Xavier might have had some kind of up-up-down-down stream on his gaming channel, so he couldn't make it. So they took her show away. Then they put her on commentary, and they yanked her right off, which was the right move. She was not a good fit for the commentary booth. That is not a good use of Renee Young's skills. Renee interviewing people, interacting with people, hosting. That is where she shines. When she's really allowed to show off her personality, that is where she shines. That is a good use of Renee Young. Renee Young being forced to conform to the rules of being a WWE announcer, of being a boring vanilla WWE announcer, is not a good use of what makes her valuable to the company. But they took that away from her. And then Fox canceled WWE Backstage a few months ago. Then she got COVID during the outbreak at the PC. Her husband says that she came back from Orlando, and a few days later she tested positive. So where do you think she got it from? She was the first WWE personality to go public about testing positive for COVID. WWE was said to not be very happy about that. Remember, they put a gag order. Supposedly, WWE put a gag order of sorts on their talent and said, do not talk publicly. And there were some wrestlers who wanted to come forward and let people know that they had it. Other people might want to keep that private, but they didn't have the choice because the company said they didn't want anybody talking about it. Well, they didn't say that to Renee. She's an announcer, and so she went and told everybody, and I guess they weren't happy with her. And then she was unhappy that nobody from WWE called to check up on her while she was sick. All of that taken together. And I guess that she just had enough. She wanted to move on. Now, she is expected to be part of the SummerSlam coverage tonight. That is probably going to be her last night with the company. She apparently does have a non-compete clause, so it could be a while before she pops up anywhere else. The obvious answer, people are going to say, and people are saying, AEW, because her husband works there, and because AEW, I think, would be crazy not to at least make an offer to her if she has any interest in working there. She could potentially do stuff maybe with AEW, but also still do stuff outside of wrestling. Maybe that's the best solution. If she wants to, I don't know, you know, work for the same company with her husband, or she just wants to keep that connection to wrestling, because she is a fan. I mean, that's how she got started, right? She was on the Score Sports Network up in Canada doing sports stuff, talking about wrestling. She's a wrestling fan. Maybe she wants to still maintain some kind of involvement in pro wrestling, but maybe she could do that with AEW, but also do other stuff as well. Maybe she doesn't go full-time in AEW. I think it's very likely we do see her in AEW at some point. I think her skills are wasted, though, if she just limits herself to wrestling. I really do. I think it's a waste. I think she's much better than that. The woman could work for a major sports network if she wanted to. That was her gig on the Score up in Canada, doing sports. She was working with Fox, right? She might still be. I know they canceled her show, but she might still have... I don't know, actually. She may not have a contract anymore with Fox. That may have gone away when they canceled her show. That I'm not sure. But she could do much better than pro wrestling. But once she's contractually free, I would be shocked if we don't see her on WWE television. But the thing with Renee is that she showed more actual human personality than any of their other announcers or backstage interviewers. She has a naturally likable personality, and she stood out more than the rest of them who, for whatever reason, either were not allowed to show their real personality or just didn't know how to. I mean, the Dasha thing, my God, the Dasha thing is a glaring example. I called her DashaBot for a reason. And after she left the company and she did that first interview, that sit-down interview with Chris Van Vliet, which is a great interview on his YouTube channel. I watched that, and I could not believe that it was the same person from WWE. I couldn't believe it was the same person. WWE could learn a thing, I think, from real sports announcers that it's okay to allow them to show off some personality and charisma of their own and have some fun during the broadcast. So long as they're getting their points across and doing their job to put over the talent and put over the events that they need to put over. Instead of worrying about promoting 15 different fucking hashtags or whatever nonsense that they force these people to talk about. Let them be themselves and develop a real chemistry with the other announcers and not some kind of forced chemistry. You know, look, the New York Mets might suck, but I will put our announcers up against any other trio in Major League Baseball. Gary Cohen, Ron Darling, and Keith Hernandez. They are the best. They've been the best probably for a decade now. They're the best. And they're fun to listen to. They're the only reason to even watch these games sometimes. There is no Gary, Keith, and Ron in WWE. There is no Monsoon and Heenan in WWE. There is no JR and King in WWE. Why? You mean to tell me that there's been some kind of announcer shortage in the last 20 years since the Attitude Era when we had the King and JR? Or 25, 30 years since Monsoon and Heenan? Or even Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura? I can list out some of my favorite announce combinations in WWE. Well, it's 2020. Why do we have to have a situation where there's nobody comparable to all of those other teams who were so much fun to listen to? I refuse to believe that the talent is not there. All of a sudden, the talent pool just got drained out in the last 20 years. I don't buy that for a second. I've heard Michael Cole call certain shows, whether it was the that initial UK tournament or the Beast in the East special in Japan. And Michael Cole is very good. Michael Cole, most of the time on WWE television these days, is absolutely insufferable. It pains me to listen to him. Now, why is that? He clearly doesn't suck. So why? Obviously, the issue is with the system that they have set up there. Renee is one of these people who stood out from the rest of the Android announcers that they had in that company. They're all forced to talk the same way, linger into the camera for very awkward, uncomfortable amounts of time. I don't get it. So that's what I'll miss about her. She was different from them. She was fun to listen to. She was fun to watch. And she is too good to waste the rest of her career working for WWE. Speaking of talking smack, Big E was on the show, the first show back yesterday with The Miz and Kayla Braxton. The audio doesn't really do it justice. Big E is sitting there and he's got his legs up on the table. Spread eagle. I don't know what he's doing. But they actually had a serious discussion. And I want to play for you the exchange here from the Talking Smack episode. It's about 3 minutes long. It is between The Miz and Big E, with Big E opening up about the lack of follow-up to Kofi Kingston's title run after he was embarrassed last year by Brock Lesnar. Lost the WWE Championship, and went right back to where he had been before as a tag team wrestler. And clearly this bugged Big E, and he spoke out about it, and The Miz had a little retort of his own. So I just want to play some of the audio for you, because I actually thought it was an interesting discussion.
Actually, before we get into any of that, can I mention, like, Kofi, I will say, is far too humble, far too do the right thing to mention this. But I'm going to say this, because it's never been said, really, not publicly. But Kofi's a guy that had his legs cut out from underneath him. To see what happened with the match with him and Brock, and then to see no title opportunity after that, he just goes back into tag teams and whatnot. You know what I mean? That's disrespectful. And I will say, we joke. Why not?
Okay, because I was WWE champion at one time, and the same thing happened to me, and I needed to rebuild and regroup myself. I wish I could have taken Kofi and said, look, you need to make sure that whatever happens after your WWE championship run, that you don't lose that main event status, that you don't feel like you are not a top star in WWE. And I honestly was a victim of that. I was. There is no doubt in my mind that I should have been where I was. But now I'm keep dedicating myself to try to be a WWE champion once again. So that's why I'm sitting out here telling you your jokey stuff. It's fun. It's great. It's entertaining. But it's not going to work to get you to the Universal Championship.
So, wait, did you wait 11 years to get your first world title opportunity? I don't think so.
No.
You didn't.
But it's been a long time since I've had another Universal Championship.
You've gotten many opportunities, and I get you're very talented. You're very deserving. Kofi waited 11 years for that one opportunity. Then it was gone. Poof. Just like that. Back to doing tag stuff. Back to doing normal stuff. And like I said, I
could
sit here.
But he allowed it. He could have fought that, couldn't he have?
How?
What do you mean, how?
Where was his opportunity?
What is the one thing they tell us when we're in developmental and when we're trying to build ourselves up? If you have 5 seconds on a television show, that is your opportunity to make people believe that you deserve better.
So
you deserve more.
So he failed himself, is what you're saying?
I always blame myself. I don't blame anybody else.
Right.
I blame myself for all my failures.
That's easy to say when you've been handed opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. You didn't wait 11 years to get your first world title opportunity, did you?
No, because I didn't have to because years. I was a star because people believed in me.
And Kofi wasn't, right?
Huh? There was no one at that time more hated, more despised than me in WWE. Nobody.
Right.
Everyone couldn't stand me, whether it was in the locker room or in the WWE universe. And that is why I propelled myself and utilized myself to be the biggest star there.
You didn't have to wait 11 years in the mid-card. You didn't have to wait 11 years doing your thing week in, week out, showing up, shaking hands, being a professional for 11 years.
I'm waiting right now. Right now.
Okay.
So I do want to bring things back.
I wasn't even supposed to be here today.
I do want to bring things back to what's happening.
And they were like, dude, we need a host, so we're going to get The Miz.
Interesting discussion. And you had to know that Kofi Kingston was obviously bothered by what happened. But he's too good of a guy to speak out about it. He's worked for that company for so long and made so many friends. And he's always been a good utility player for them in that they were always able to use him in whatever situation they needed him for, whether it was Intercontinental, whether it was tag team. He's had so many tag team partners, not just New Day, but Evan Bourne and other people that he's tagged up with over the years, that I can't picture Kofi going out there and shooting on the company while he works for them. But Big E had no problem in that segment opening up about it. So I think we may end up getting some interesting moments out of this Talking Smack show. It really was a fun show to watch before. And they had that classic segment that came out of it with The Miz and Daniel Bryan, the whole work shoot thing. They kind of blur the lines a little bit on that show. So this could be worth checking out as the weeks go on. Now let me talk about Monday Night Raw here. Before we even talk about Thunderdome from Friday night, let me talk about this Monday Night Raw show, this final Raw before SummerSlam, the first hour of which was complete garbage, and it didn't get much better after that. The Retribution guys, they interrupted a Drew McIntyre promo at the beginning of the show. They were in the production truck, and they were screwing around in there. They were breaking a bunch of laptops, and they threatened one of the staffers into pushing a single button that immediately took the show off the air and to a commercial break. I was hoping they would grab Kevin Dunn and break one of those laptops over his head for all of the camera cuts that he subjects us to, but they didn't. They did not, thus ensuring to me that they remain heels. But Retribution, you know, they wanted so badly to take the show off the air on Monday night that they allowed the show to come back from commercial and continue on as normal. What a bunch of nice guys and girls. Apollo Crews pinned Shelton Benjamin in 2 minutes after R-Truth came running through the ring, being chased after by Tozawa and his ninjas for the 24/7 crap belt. And this distracted Benjamin long enough to be rolled up and pinned. This sucked. Let me put some stank on it here. This sucked. This company is so creatively bankrupt. It is not even funny. You know, when the Hurt Business attacked Cruz and Ricochet and Cedric Alexander and Mustafa Pin Me ran out to make the save. That led to an elimination match later on in the night. Truth also ran back out again and Benjamin knocked him out and pinned him to win the 24/7 crap belt. Awful. Awful, awful, awful. The woman from The Bachelor was there. Demi Moore or Lovato, whatever. Demi something. And she's still hanging around with Angel Garza. And Ivar showed up and he had a turkey leg in his hand. Anyway, the two of them had a match. Garza won in 3 minutes. Angelo Dawkins appeared on the Titantron with the Bachelor lady and said that he had come into possession of some interesting video that he was threatening to show the world. And this led to him showing footage of Zelina Vega spiking Montez Ford's drink and seemingly being the one to poison him. So they went the predictable route after all. And then Montez Ford showed up and he fought the heels until they ran off. And later in the show, he beat Andrade in 3 minutes. Can you guess the finish? Can you guess what happened? He beat him with a roll-up. Mickie James. Mickie James wrestled her first match on Monday Night Raw since January of 2019. Her first televised match of any kind since WrestleMania 35's kickoff show last year. Then she got hurt and she was out for a while. And she came back here on Raw and she lost in 3 minutes to Natalya. Shockingly, it was not by roll-up, but by count-out. Which may be the only other finish that sucks almost as bad as the roll-up. Beat her by count-out. In a match where the camera was mostly fixed on Seth Rollins talking to Samoa Joe by the commentary desk about Rey Mysterio. Lana had gotten up on the apron. Mickey was climbing up for a move, so that briefly distracted Mickey, and that gave Natty a chance to knock her off the top rope down to the floor, and she couldn't crawl back inside before the 10 count. A hell of a return here for the former women's champion, and the third straight match on this show, lasting under 4 minutes. Now, Vince Russo chimed in, bro, on what happened here. Vince Russo thinks that Mickey's husband, bro, Nick Aldis, speaking ill of Bruce Pritchard, bro, who just so happens to be heading the creative department in WWE, bro, that may have led to Bruce burying her here on this show, bro, burying her on purpose in her return, bro. I think the bro may be onto something here, bro. I think Russo may actually be onto something. And on something. He's onto something and he's on something. But I think he might be going down the right track here. Then we finally got a real match. This one was actually, it actually broke the 10-minute mark. Asuka and Shayna Baszler against Sasha Banks and Bayley. About a minute in, Nia Jax, who I thought was indefinitely suspended for beating up Pat Fuck or Buck. She was in the audience and attacked Baszler. Actually, Pat Fuck did run out, and he yelled at Nia Jax. Asuka wrestled her by herself for a while. Baszler eventually did come back and made the hot tag. Got Bayley in the Kirifuda clutch. Sasha broke it up. Asuka put Sasha in the Asuka lock outside the ring, and Bayley tapped out to lose. She tapped out inside the clutch. We had Apollo Crews in the back telling Cedric Alexander, who I guess had been put in the full Nelson earlier in the night, or the full Lashley. I believe that's what Tom Phillips referred to it as. It's the full Lashley. I don't need to be seeing the full Lashley. Half a Lashley from the waist up is enough. You keep your full Lashley to yourself, okay, pal? But Apollo Crews was telling Cedric, look, you're hurt. We're going to do the six-man tag. It's going to be me. It's going to be Ricochet. It's going to be Mustafa pin me. You stay back here. We don't need you. And this, of course, was not something that Cedric wanted to hear. He was very unhappy about this. They left him in the back. Actual storyline advancement here. Foreshadowing. Later on, MVP, he sidles up on next to Cedric. He sits right next to him. And he's playing up the fact that you look frustrated here. You're sitting in the back all by yourself. These guys don't want you out there with them. These are your friends. He goes, you know that offer I made to you a few weeks ago to join the Hurt Business? That offer still stands. And MVP walked off. So we were back in the underground this week. Raw Underground. Eric of the Viking Raiders won a match. Dolph Ziggler was watching. He was observing the match with Shane McMahon. And he gave Eric a 4 out of 10. Bret Hart would be proud. He gave him a 4 out of 10 for his effort. Eric invited him into the ring. And we had Eric against Dolph Ziggler. And Ziggler was losing, so he put a thumb in Eric's eye. Thumbed him in the eye, put him out in a sleeper hold. The dreaded sleeper hold. Which, really, I mean, if you put a sleeper hold on somebody, I know it's kind of a cliched move, a very basic move. Kind of like the DDT. But a well-executed DDT, like a well-applied sleeper hold, can put somebody out like a light, like that. But you got to treat the move like something special. So he put him out. And Ivar was not happy about what he did to his partner. And so now they're going to have a Raw Underground match tomorrow night. It's going to be unbelievable. We're 3 weeks into this, okay? We are 3 weeks now, going to be 3 weeks into Raw Underground. And the concept has already been reduced to Ivar against Dolph Ziggler. They may as well call it Main Event Underground. That should be the new name of it. Rey Mysterio is back. He has a one-eyed mask now. One of the eyes is covered. And his son Dominic, they came out. He said he was proud of the ass-kicking that his son took the week before. He would be in his corner to watch him against Seth Rollins at the SummerSlam. Rollins came out. Greater good. Yada, yada, yada. He and Murphy got into the ring and Dominic bailed. Like cowards. But they had a plan. They grabbed kendo sticks. They got back in the ring. They attacked Rollins. They attacked Murphy. And they tied Rollins up in the ropes. They were going to do to Rollins what Rollins had done to Dominic. But then Murphy came in and Rollins escaped. So I guess it wasn't so hard to break free from the ropes after all. Took Rollins 2 seconds to get out of the ropes. Poor Dominic. He was helpless. He was defenseless. I guess young Dominic has much to learn about how to escape the ropes. He's got to learn the tricks of the trade. His father ought to teach him. Back at Raw Underground, we had Arturo Huas against Riddick Moss. They fought to a non-finish, which is ridiculous. There should be no non-finishes in the Underground. Who ever heard of such a thing? They separated them. Who wants to see that? In Raw Underground, you should fight to the death. You should fight to the death or until one man is no longer able to compete. So that big six-man elimination match, Lashley pinned Mustafa pinned me in about 90 seconds. And then 30 seconds later, Shelton Benjamin pinned Ricochet after hitting pay dirt to make it 3-on-1 against Apollo Crews. They got rid of these guys so fast. Absolutely buried the shit out of these two guys. Unless they're revealed to be part of this retribution group, it would appear that there is little hope for either one of these guys in this company, either Mustafa or Ricochet, because this was just a gigantic burial here in this match. But Cruz eliminated Benjamin. Cedric ran down. He pinned Benjamin on the outside to win the 24/7 crap belt, celebrated as if it was some kind of big achievement. That would be like me walking down the sidewalk and I see dog crap on the sidewalk and I pick it up and I hold it up and I start celebrating. Is it really some kind of big achievement? Cruz eliminated MVP. And he fought a good fight, but he fell to the spear from Lashley. So the champion loses 6 days before SummerSlam, but he loses to a guy who... Now they have a built-in excuse coming out of the pay-per-view tonight where Lashley could say for payback next weekend, hey, I beat you last week on TV. Give me the shot. I'm going to challenge you for the United States Championship. So in a way, it kind of sets things up perfectly if that's the direction they want to go in. Cedric came back out to defend the 24/7 crap belt later on against Tozawa. He beat him with the lumbar check. Lumbar check is still a beautiful move. I love that. I love that finish. It really, you know what though, it really depends on the person selling it and taking the move. You gotta take it the right way. But it's a beautiful move. And then after the match, Shelton Benjamin flies in, hits pay dirt, and wins back the 24/7 crap belt. This is all just very sad to watch. This is television for the sake of killing time on television. Do they actually think that this is good television? They can't possibly think that this is good television. This is just them trying to fill time. Surely this is just them doing time filler on TV. Because when I see segments like this, it makes me think, boy, is it sad to see what this show has been reduced to. Think of all the years of Monday Night Raw with the classic matches and classic moments and angles and skits and stuff. And to see what this show has now been reduced to, I feel bad for the newer fans. I really do. I genuinely feel bad for the young fans and the newer fans. There's a reason that 10-year-old Jordan called into my stream the other day and said that he went back to watch the old stuff and his favorite wrestler is Stone Cold Steve Austin. His second favorite wrestler was The Ultimate Warrior. Now, what does that say to you when you have younger fans who have to go back in time and pick the classics as their favorite wrestlers? That would be like me when I was 10 years old. If somebody asked me, hey, who's your favorite wrestler? Well, you know, I went back and that Bruno guy, you know, or the Baron Michael Cicluna guy, you know, or superstar Billy Graham, Bob Backlund, Al, what was his name? What was the guy? Al, oh my God, the guy who looks like Seth Rollins. I forgot his name. Anyway, there's a lot of names from that era, but that would be ridiculous, right? When I'm 10 years old, I'm going back 15 years to tell you who my favorite wrestler is. But what does that say? This show is absolute dreck. Back to the Underground. We had Shane as friends, Marina Shafir and Jessamyn Duke in the house. Shafir beat somebody with a leg submission, then got jumped by Nia Jax. Yes, Nia Jax. Now we have jumped the shark. Nia Jax on Raw Underground. This concept has gone completely off the rails. Ivar against Dolph Ziggler next week. Nia Jax invades the Underground. This has just gone completely the way I was hoping it would not go. Shayna jumped in. They teased the fight between them. Jax bailed. And then we got the heartbreak middle-aged man, Shawn Michaels, down to the ring in his NXT hat to talk about what Randy Orton did to Ric Flair the week before. This was not needed. This would have been so much better if they shot the angle with Flair on this go-home show. Shawn Michaels had nothing to do with any of this. Shawn Michaels had no business being there. Shawn Michaels did not need to be there. Shawn Michaels added nothing to this angle except the fact that he... Well, let's explain what happened here. I went off on this the other night. I'm more than happy to go off on this again. So Randy Orton sneaks up from behind Shawn Michaels. He gives him an RKO. And Shawn Michaels falls and his hat goes flying off his head. And then he immediately punts him in the head. He punts Shawn Michaels in the skull. Drew McIntyre runs down. He chases Randy Orton out of the ring. And Shawn Michaels barely sells the punt. Now, it's one thing to see Randy Orton kick Ric Flair, who is 71 years of age. You had Edge, you had Christian, Big Show, all these people, people younger than Shawn Michaels in some cases, who have been punted, who have sold it. They're either seeing stars, their eyes are open, or they're knocked unconscious, or whatever the case may be. Now, in this case, Shawn Michaels took both of Randy Orton's finishes. He took the RKO and the punt back-to-back. How often do we see that? How often do we see somebody eat a punt and an RKO back-to-back? And Shawn Michaels goes and sits up in the corner, and by the time the segment was over and Orton had come back and he had dropped McIntyre with an RKO, it looked like Shawn was trying to check on Drew to make sure Drew was okay. It's as if none of this ever happened. He made this move look so weak. And the only thing I could come up with here, because Shawn Michaels is a very good professional wrestler, he's very good with ring psychology, there's no excuse for Shawn Michaels, who was down there at NXT, assisting with creative and teaching these young guys now and young women, there's no reason for him to no-sell the guy's finish as he's going into SummerSlam to challenge for the championship. Only thing I could come up with is his hat went flying off his head, and Shawn Michaels does not have a lot of hair on his head anymore. His hair, he's an old man. He looks like an old man. And he's very self-conscious about the way he looks and about the hair thinning on top and everything else, and he just wanted to sit upright so the camera wasn't aimed directly at his head. That's the only thing I could think of. This was ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. So that was my thoughts on Monday Night Raw. What was that guy's name? What was the wrestler I was thinking of? This is going to really drive me nuts. He was a wrestler, I don't know about the 70s, but like in the 80s. I can't remember the guy's name. I have his face. He looks like Seth Rollins. I have his face in. Let me see if I can look this guy up. This is going to drive me insane. He is he actually did a shoot interview not too long ago, and I just can't remember the guy's name. Oh, Al Perez. That's who I'm thinking of. Okay. Al Perez. That'd be like me, 10-year-old me, going, my favorite wrestler is Al Perez. I've gone back and I've watched his work. Al fucking Perez. Holy shit. Where did I drag that one out from? So then we get to SmackDown at the Thunderdome. They promoted Vince McMahon all day as being on the show. No entrance for the chairman. He was already standing in the ring. He was immediately interrupted by The Fiend, who got a full entrance. Vince McMahon did not even flinch when The Fiend got in the ring to confront him face to face. And Vince would take one step, The Fiend would take one step. He wasn't letting him leave the ring. And Vince did not look fazed by any of this. He looked like he was about to throw down with The Fiend. A far cry from when Seth Rollins comically cowered in fear in the corner like a little bitch last fall. Braun Strowman walked to the ring and Marty Jannetty made Vince disappear because he was nowhere to be found. Vince McMahon was gone. Suddenly, the Retribution goofballs, they run out, they surround the ring, The Fiend waves bye-bye, and the lights go out. And when they come back on, The Fiend is gone, and Braun Strowman is left all alone to fend off the Nexus Ninjas. He's overwhelmed. Out come all of the members of the SmackDown roster to fight them off, and in this entire melee, or as Vince McMahon would say, since it is his birthday and all this week, melee, in this entire melee, not one of the WWE stars thought to try to unmask any of these fuckers. Really? I didn't see anybody even attempting to pull a mask off. They don't seem particularly concerned about their identities, I guess. So that was stupid. Now, The Miz brought it up the rear. He was the last one out. He was late to the party. Retribution had already been chased away. Not the first time that The Miz has expressed a lack of interest in fighting them off, so this was not an accident. They want you to think that The Miz may have something to do with Retribution. The Miz with Retribution. I could tell you one thing. That would not do much to fix the problem of getting me to take these people seriously. That just does not sound like a good fit to me. But maybe he's allied with them. Maybe he knows who they are and he's helping them out in some way. I'll tell you what. You know what? I'm going to pitch my own story here. And maybe this is the way it goes and maybe it isn't. The idea of The Miz being in a leadership position with Retribution is just fucking foolish. So forget about that. But I could envision a story or a scenario where The Miz, you know, these people are disenfranchised. There's a reason they call themselves Retribution. So we are to assume that these people are members of the roster, members of the NXT roster. They are disenfranchised in some way, and they are seeking revenge for the way that they have been treated or mistreated or misused. That is something that The Miz could sympathize with. And actually, something he said in that Talking Smack clip that I played for you earlier could play right into this, where he was telling Big E, look, dude, I'm in the same place Kofi was in, man. I wish they would do more with me. I put the work in. I try, and I'm still waiting for my moment to get my turn again. And maybe in storyline, that is why I could see someone like Miz being aligned with, or he's kind of like a mole. He's the guy on the inside who's helping them out, letting them into the buildings. You know, he's providing help to these people because he sympathizes with them. He feels the same way that they do, where he feels he's underappreciated and he is not being treated the way that he feels he should be treated. So yeah, he's in no rush to go down and brawl with them and fight with them because he's helping them. He's the guy on the inside, not the leader, but he's an ally. And that is a story that I think could work. But Miz in some kind, he's the leader of Retribution. That is just laughable. Absolutely laughable. The other way that I just pitched, that could work. That could work. Because The Miz is a former WWE champion, main eventer of WrestleMania. He has not been treated like that in a very long time. So you could believe that even in storyline, forget, you know, behind the scenes, you could believe that in real life, maybe he feels that way, but in storyline, The Miz is tired of being a tag team wrestler. He's tired of being marginalized. And so you know what? I'm going to help these guys. Because we gotta wreck some shit. We got to wreak havoc here in chaos. And I'm going to help these guys do that. Now, in all of the mayhem here, Jeff Hardy got hurt in the storyline. He thought that it may have been Retribution that attacked him, but Upon seeing a replay, we saw that it was AJ Styles who walked right up behind Jeff and stomped on his leg, tried to take him out of their Intercontinental title match later in the show. I figured that maybe they were doing that as a way to delay the match until SummerSlam, because there is no Intercontinental Championship match as I am sitting here recording this right now, Sunday morning. There is no Intercontinental title match scheduled for SummerSlam tonight, which is crazy. And somebody pointed out to me the other day that there hasn't been an Intercontinental Championship defense on pay-per-view in months. But that's not what happened. Jeff asked for a brace, a knee brace, and the doctor said, look, I know you got a high threshold for pain, so if you can tolerate the pain, I'll clear you and I'll let you wrestle. And so they put a brace on him and the match was on. Big E pins Sheamus with a roll-up. Yes, another fucking roll-up. Does absolutely nothing for either man. What does that accomplish? What does a roll-up win accomplish for Big E? It's a fluke. That's basically what it is. He gets a fluke win over Sheamus. That means nothing. And it does no favors for Sheamus. You know, again, I have no problem. I would have no problem with roll-up finishes if they were used sparingly. That goes for WWE. That goes for AEW. That goes for any promotion. But WWE uses it as a crutch on every single show, every single week. I have to say, one of the things that I appreciate about AEW, no disqualifications. When was the last time you saw a match in AEW end in a disqualification? You haven't. The only disqualification I can ever remember there being on an AEW show did not actually end the match. It was one fall in the Iron Man match on TV that Pac had with Kenny Omega. Pac, I think, got himself disqualified in the first fall, but it didn't end the match. And that is literally the only disqualification of any kind I could ever remember seeing on AEW television. And I think there is a place for countouts and there's a place for DQs in certain situations. I'm not saying eliminate all DQs. You need to have disqualifications, but the first time we see it, it should be meaningful. I'm talking in AEW now. The first time we do see a DQ finish to a match, it should mean something. It should play into the story in some way because we see them so seldomly. WWE is just lazy. They're lazy with the roll-ups and rarely does it serve any kind of real purpose because they're too chicken shit to beat people. They have no guts. One of the many reasons why it is hard for people to ever really get over in this company. If you want Big E to win, Big E is the one getting the big push right now. If you want Big E to win, then let him win, you fucking cowards. Let him win. This was not, oh, he rolled him up, he won. No, that's not a win. That's a cop-out. And if Sheamus is pissed off in storyline, then you can bring him back again and let Big E beat him again. Because Big E is the one that you're trying to build credibility for as a singles competitor. And a win over Sheamus, two wins over Sheamus. Sheamus has been around long enough where that would be meaningful. Sheamus has been on the roster for 11 years. So getting a win or two over him could mean something. A roll-up means nothing. Show some guts. And actually try to get these people over. Cesaro and Nakamura. They beat the Lucha House Party. Metalik took a nasty spill on a dive out over the top rope. I think he was trying to take over Cesaro with a Rana, but he just went splat. Just landed splat on the floor. Lince Dorado tried for the takeover Rana Rey Mysterio used to do, but Cesaro rolled through and pinned him. Kalisto was on the outside. He was very upset, and he got into it with Lince. Metalik tried to be peacekeeper between them. They were shoving each other. Kalisto came back looking like $1 million. You know, he transformed his body. He got a new mask. Kalisto's looking like a new man. So it looks like this may be the beginning of the end for the Lucha House Party. The party may be over. And perhaps a singles push is in the works for Kalisto for a few weeks before he ends up back on main event. We had a beat the clock challenge with Sasha Banks and Bayley taking on Naomi in two separate matches. The woman who wins in the shortest amount of time would defend her title second against Asuka tonight at SummerSlam. Banks and Naomi had a very basic, dull match. I didn't like that spot Naomi did where she did this very slow, like, handstand and just waited for Sasha to come in so that she could... I didn't like that. That looked so contrived. Sasha won in 3.5 minutes, so that was the time for Bayley to beat. Naomi then beat Bayley with the rear view. She put her ass in her face, which means that Bayley has to defend her championship first tonight. Asuka came out because brand split? What brand split? What brand split? And they're going to have a draft. they're going to have a draft. And she kicked both their asses and then she danced. Mandy Rose. Mandy Rose cut a promo in the back offering to drop the match with Sonya Deville after the tough week that she had. And let's put our issues behind us. I guess they felt they had to acknowledge the incident in some way, which they did not have to do that, but they felt they did. And so when Sonya came out on stage for her response, she cut this fire promo on Mandy, saying there will be a match at SummerSlam, you're not going to get out of this. She said, you know what, I already cut your hair, and I don't care if I get my head shaved, so how about this? Let's forget about that stipulation, let's up the ante a little bit, let's raise the stakes. We're going to make this match on Sunday, no disqualification, and the loser has to leave WWE. So we got the loser leaves town stipulation here. It could very well be that either she requested or they said, look, take some time off after what happened. Take a few weeks off. And maybe Sonya Deville is going to go away. Maybe Sonya Deville is going to be off for a little while after that home invasion. But I would like to see her end the night tonight as the SmackDown Women's Champion. That's what I would like to see. We need more Sonya on the show, not less. AJ Styles against the one-legged enigma, Jeff Hardy, out in his brace, limping to the ring. This was a big disappointment. You know, you had Jeff selling a knee injury the entire time. There is nothing exciting about spending the entire match selling a knee injury, coming into the match with the knee injury, selling the knee injury. It's not the kind of match that people would have wanted to see. We haven't seen AJ Styles and Jeff Hardy one-on-one since the TNA days. This was not the kind of match I think people were expecting and hoping from these two guys. So this fell flat for me. AJ went for the Styles clash, Jeff kicked out of it, and in doing so, he struck AJ in the face with his knee brace. Hardy hit the Twist of Fate, Swanton Bomb for the win, and for the fifth time in his career, Jeff Hardy is the Intercontinental Champion. Kayla Braxton got in the ring to interview Jeff after the match. He talked about the dark hole he found himself in last year. He was in a very bad place, overcoming his struggles. It was such a touching promo. It was such a touching moment that they played him off. Like the way they do to some of these winners during the Oscars when they talk for too long. They play music. That's their cue to get the fuck off the stage. They played off Jeff Hardy. They played his music. That was their cue for him to wrap up his sob story. In the back, AJ pitched a fit at Joseph Park, blamed his statistics for being wrong. I love this because this makes me very happy. That means we're keeping Joseph Park on TV. That gets a thumbs up from me. And we got a Firefly Funhouse to end the show. Braun Strowman, he found the Funhouse and beat the hell out of Bray Wyatt. He dragged him right into a commercial break. Corey Graves. Corey Graves on commentary. And I know he's being fed these lines. But Corey Graves was tripping over his own words, trying to explain this or come up with something to say about this. Talking about, trying to explain how Braun Strowman somehow was able to find the Firefly Funhouse, which he said was located in some kind of parallel universe. Braun Strowman was able to locate the door to this alternate dimension. Ignoring the fact that Seth Rollins did the exact same thing once and burned the place down. But forget that. I like the idea. The idea that I like is the idea that Bray Wyatt, everybody knows that Bray Wyatt has serious psychological issues or split personality disorder or whatever. Maybe not. Maybe he does have serious psychological problems. And people recognize this. It's kind of what makes him so dangerous. You never know how he's going to act. He laughs and then he gets all serious and then he laughs again. It's very unnerving to be around somebody like that because you never know how they're going to react and what they're going to do. I kind of like that story more. where you acknowledge that, okay, yes, this guy is not from another dimension, right? He's got problems, and this is how these problems manifest themselves. I like that story better. Instead, they acted like there's a wormhole in the Amway Center, and Braun Strowman was able to crawl into the wormhole, into another galaxy or another dimension. So they're fighting in the back, and Braun gets him over by the ledge. I guess there was a loading dock, the loading dock area. And he chokeslams Bray off the ledge. And that's fine, because you don't see it, right? Then you can cut to a shot of Bray 8 feet down, 10 feet down, splattered on the ground. And we've seen them do angles like this before. I think Big Show did this once, right? Didn't Big Show chokeslam SmackDown commissioner Kurt Angle to his death or something once, I think, on SmackDown? Anyway, the problem is, when he chokeslam Bray, you could see Bray's foot in the final shot. It looked as if he was landing on a crash pad. There was no 5 foot, 8 foot, 10 foot drop. He kind of almost choke shoved him, and you could see Bray's foot in the shot. And maybe it was a foot or two below. And not only did they show that in the replay, they kept it in the replay as well. It looked completely ridiculous. So an ambulance shows up. They load Bray into the ambulance. It starts to drive away. Adam Pearce was screaming and hollering, "You're going the wrong way!" Because the ambulance was starting to back up. "You're going the wrong way!" He's shouting and screaming and losing his mind. Then all of a sudden, the light inside the ambulance turns blood red. And the doors swing open and there's smoke. And standing in the background is the Fiend. It's not Bray Wyatt, Funhouse Bray. It is the Fiend, who laughs into the camera as they go off the air. He's laughing at this creative, is what he's laughing at. But if this finish looked familiar to you, there's a reason for that. It's because we've seen it once before. During the Authority era, with Kane. Seth Rollins beat down Corporate Kane so bad that Corporate Kane had to be loaded onto a stretcher and loaded up into an ambulance. And the ambulance was going away, but then it stopped, and the doors, the light inside the ambulance, just like here, turns red. And the doors swing open and there's smoke, and who emerges from the ambulance? Demon Kane. He transformed into Demon Kane. It was a cool-looking shot, but one that they recycled from another angle they did just a few years ago, right down to the red light. Some people may have forgotten about that. I still remembered that. But Strowman is in full-on heel mode now. I don't know if the Fiend is supposed to be the babyface or not, but after this angle, if they had people in the building for this, he'd be cheered wildly like a babyface. I still think it's a setup by Strowman and Alexa. Nikki's going to be involved. Nikki is going to get involved in some way. I hope the Fiend wins. That's why I'm picking him now to win. Strowman, to me, has been a bust as the Universal Champion. Does nothing for me. Some final notes with AEW preempted last Wednesday. NXT grew its audience by 234,000 viewers, up to 853,000 this past week, and that was against some stiff sports competition. So I would consider that a good number. They had to break 800K. That was sort of the benchmark that I set last week. I said, they have to at least get to 800K. It'll be pathetic if they can't. And just completely hopeless if they couldn't do that. And they got 853. That was their best audience since November of last year. The shoe is going to be on the other foot in a few weeks because NXT is going to be preempted on September 2nd for the NHL playoffs. So AEW will have that night all to themselves, aside from all the sports, of course. But they're going to have the night wrestling-wise all to themselves. And instead, the NXT show that week will air one day earlier on Tuesday, September 1st at 8 p.m. Sad tweet goes to Ricky Morton of the Rock and Roll Express, who tweeted on Thursday afternoon, "Whoever ordered 4 pizzas and sent them to my house, not cool. Stop invading my privacy." And he then tweeted, the pizzas weren't even paid for. If you're going to at least surprise me, pay for them. For God's sake, stop sending pizzas to Ricky Morton. And if you put pineapple on the pizza, I hope they track you down and arrest you for crimes against humanity. So there's your sad tweet of the week. If you have mailbag questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com, and always include your name and where you are from. That will improve your chances of having your question read here on the show. Now, I've got some wrestling questions, but before I get to the wrestling questions, last month, Brian, I want to give a shout out to Brian Tymeyer on Twitter. He suggested that for episode 666, I should try to do some kind of countdown or, you know, list out my five best horror movies or something like that, something tied into the horror theme. And I'm not going to do a whole countdown or anything like that, but I thought, you know what, that would be a cool idea to give some thought to what I think are my five favorite horror films of all time. And so, these are my five favorites. I'm going to just read them off to you right now. These are the movies that either scared the shit out of me, or messed with my head big time, or no matter what I'm doing, if they come on TV, I don't have cable anymore, thank God. But if I were to come across them, I would stop whatever I'm doing and I would watch. There's a select number of films that would apply to, and I think that would apply to these. Now, if you ask somebody who is a fan of the horror genre, what are your favorite all-time horror films, you're going to get a lot of the same answers. You're going to get Psycho, and I've seen Psycho, and it's a very good movie, but you're going to get Psycho, you're going to get The Exorcist, you're going to get The Shining. These are all classic films. They are not on my list. They are not on my list, but they are classic films, no doubt about it. But these are the films on my list. And this one should be a surprise to nobody who knows me. Halloween. The original Halloween by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, 1978, which was really an independent film. It wasn't like it was backed by a major film studio, and I think it made $50 million. And, you know, it put John Carpenter on the map in many ways. And then he had a lot of other movies that came out of the 1980s, including Halloween sequels. But there would not have been a Friday the 13th. You know, the whole slasher genre really, to me, starts with Michael Myers in the Halloween films. So you wouldn't have a Friday the 13th, any of the movies, were it not for Halloween. And I love the movie. There's really no blood. There's no blood. There's no gore. It's the sense of dread. It's the William Shatner mask that they sort of messed around with, the Shatner mask, that blank expression on his face, the idea that it's this kid who one day woke up in 1963, I think it was, and put a Halloween mask on and stabbed his sister to death for no reason at all. There's no explanation for why this little six-year-old boy woke up one day and stabbed his sister to death. And it's that sense of not knowing, there's not an explanation or a motive for it. They put him in an institution. He's mute. He doesn't speak. That's what really makes it kind of terrifying. When they started ascribing different reasons for why Michael is the way he is in the later movies, it completely negated everything that made the first movie so scary and so spooky. Not knowing is oftentimes scarier than having all the answers. So I loved everything about the movie, the way it was shot, the music, the mask, the simplicity of it. But, you know, it's a movie that it gets to you. Now, maybe somebody who's a little bit younger, who's been exposed to all of these slasher gore, horror porn flicks and everything, they may watch a movie like Halloween and be like, I don't see what the big deal is. I feel like you had to be there. You know what I mean? Like if you were watching these movies when you were younger and hadn't yet watched all of these other movies now, which just push all the boundaries and all the limits to what you can do. And just visually, they show you everything. Then yeah, I could see where you would watch a movie like this and you wouldn't get it. But to me, it is the best. It is the best. It is my favorite horror film of all time, the original. I'm a fan of some of the other ones too, but the original is still and always will be the very best. Speaking of John Carpenter, The Thing. John Carpenter's remake, his version of The Thing from 1982. Now, it's not the original, but It is my favorite version of it, and it is a great movie. The Thing was not received well when it was first released. I think it came out in 1982, if I'm not mistaken, but it was not well received when it first came out. In fact, the reviews were horrible. People thought the effects and the gore were just way too much. There were stories of people leaving the movie theater, walking out of the theater midway through. They were completely distraught over what they had just seen. And John Carpenter had a contract with the movie studio. He had signed on, you know, with the success of Halloween, and I think Escape from New York may have came before this as well. But he got a big contract. He was going to do a whole bunch of movies for the movie studio. And I think largely based on the reaction to this film, they bought him out of his deal early. They just wanted to end the relationship, and they bought him out. And as much of a classic as it's considered today, it is amazing to think that it was that badly received when it first came out. But it came out around the same time that E.T. did. And E.T. was a more wholesome movie, and people loved E.T. I loved E.T. E.T. kind of freaked me out too, I gotta tell you. When they had the people coming in the hazmat suits, and they had him in the bubble, and they were separating him from the family members, that was kind of traumatic for me as a kid, I'm not gonna lie. There were parts of E.T. that were traumatic, and it had nothing to do with me being afraid of E.T. It was when the government came in, right? Government comes in, they fucked it all up. But E.T. came out, I think the same year maybe. It came out right around the same time, and that just got... people adored it. People loved it. And I guess people just weren't ready for this yet. I guess. I don't know. I don't have any other explanation for it. We've all been so desensitized to it now. Back then, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a very niche audience. If people went to go see it, they knew what they were getting. I guess with this thing, no pun intended, I don't know that people knew what they were expecting, or they were expecting one thing and they got another, but they were repulsed by what they saw. But I love it. It's one of my favorite movies. That sense of dread and tension as the movie goes on, the use of the practical effects. I don't know why it got so much hate from people at the time. 10 years earlier, you had The Exorcist come out, and people were literally throwing up in the movie theater. People were passing out. They were calling ambulances because people were passing out and needed oxygen in the movie theater when that movie came out. And that movie was acclaimed. That movie was widely praised. So I don't get it. Now, this might ruffle a few feathers. People might hear this and go, what? You horror movie? Oh, yeah. Jaws. Jaws is one of the greatest horror movies ever made. I don't give a shit what people classify it as. I don't care what IMDb says. They call it action. They call it a thriller. Yeah, it was all those things. And it was a horror movie, too. Any movie that makes millions of people afraid to go into the water because of a killer shark is a horror movie. I don't care what anybody says. Die Hard is a Christmas movie, and Jaws is a horror movie. Period. End of story. Really, nothing else needs to be said. Jaws is still a movie that scares a lot of people to this very day. There are still people to this day who will not go to the beach and will not go in the water because of that movie. If that's not a horror movie, then I don't know what is. But Jaws is a great movie. Alien. I got a funny story on this. I actually saw the movie Spaceballs as a kid before I ever saw Alien. So I'm very weird like that. Like, I saw Escape from L.A. before I ever saw Escape from New York. I see these movies out of order sometimes. You know, I saw the second season of True Detective on HBO. I still haven't seen the first season. I heard it's so great. Oh, my God. And people crapped on the second season. I haven't seen the first season. I saw the second season with Vince Vaughn, and I thought it was okay. I got to go back and watch the first one. But anyway. I saw the movie Spaceballs as a kid before I ever saw Alien. And if you've never seen Spaceballs, it's a parody movie, basically. And one of the scenes in the movie is a parody of a scene from, probably the most memorable scene, from the movie Alien, where the alien pops out of John Hurt's chest. Only in Spaceballs, when the alien pops out of his chest, And it's the same actor, by the way, which was hilarious. They used John Hurt. They brought him back for Spaceballs. When the alien pops out of his chest, he looks, he goes, oh, no, not again. But in Spaceballs, when the alien comes out, it dances off to the music like Michigan J. Frog with a top hat and a cane. So when I finally saw Alien years later and I saw that thing burst out of his chest, I started singing, hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime gal. I'm like, where's the music? That's the first thing I thought of. And so, unfortunately, when I saw Alien for the first time, that scene should have scared the crap out of me. And instead, I was laughing, waiting for the music to start playing. Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Anyway, Sigourney Weaver, total badass forever because of this movie. Alien, great film. Alien 2, also. And rounding out the list is the original Saw movie from 2004. Now, it got ridiculous as the years went on with the sequels and everything. I actually thought the first movie was brilliant. I thought it was very clever, the concept of it and the big finale. I will not give away the finale of the movie in case people still haven't seen it after all. I mean, it's been almost 20 years now. But if you've never seen the movie, it's not fair because it's all in the payoff at the end of this movie. But I remember the first time I saw that Saw movie, and I didn't know if I was going to like it or not. I didn't, because I knew going in there was a lot of gore. If you can't handle gore and a lot of blood and stuff, you're not going to like this movie. But there's a story there. It's not just the gore for the sake of gore. And the concept of the story, these two guys who don't know each other, finding themselves locked, chained by the feet, one on one side, one on the other. They don't know how they got there. They have to play a series of games and tasks that they might not want to do in order to try to save themselves or save their family. It's a horrifying situation. If you try to, in real life, put yourself in these people's positions, that's the truly horrifying part. I don't know what I would do. If I was Carrie Elwes tied like that, you know, I don't know what I would do. I don't think I would have the courage to do what, you know, Jigsaw wanted him to do. But I remember watching the end of that movie and my jaw dropped. I didn't see it coming. It's like SummerSlam this year. They'll never see it coming. I didn't see that coming. I should have seen it coming and I didn't see it coming. I remember Kane, and I wish I could find the interview. I've looked for it. I can't find it. I don't remember if it, I think it was a written article, not a video interview. And it might have been around the time Kane was doing press for his own movie. See No Evil. But I could have sworn even Kane commented on the fact that he thought that was like one of his favorite movies. And like he was blown away by the finish as well. And I thought, good. See, now I'm not alone in that. So I would not put any of the other films on this list. But the original, I absolutely think this is among the greatest movies in the horror genre. It's not the best horror film of all time. But if you made a top 10 or a top 20... I think there's a place for the original Saw on that list. So that's what my top five looks like. I have a whole bunch of other favorites. Obviously, I like all the Friday the 13th movies with my namesake. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. A lot of people have crapped on that movie. Because, oh, it's not Michael Myers. Isn't that a real Halloween movie? But if you ever take the time to watch it, it's a damn good film. I really liked Halloween 3. In fact, I think Halloween 3 is my second favorite. The original Halloween and then Halloween 3 are my top two favorite Halloween films. I love Creepshow, which is just a collection of different horror stories. The one I like the most is The Crate, Fluffy, The Monster Under the Steps. The Fly with Jeff Goldblum. Now there's a movie, the effects. You want to talk about effects and gore that'll creep you out. But it's a really sad story, though. It's a really sad story, but those practical effects, man, nothing can beat that. I'm sorry. CGI has a place, but nothing can beat those practical effects from the 1980s. Fright Night, that's another guilty pleasure of mine. Well, not a guilty pleasure. I think a lot of people like that movie. The original Child's Play, the Chucky movie, the first one they did. That is a creepy fucking movie, especially if you're afraid of dolls. If you're afraid of creepy dolls, not like the Annabelle doll, but if you're just creeped out by dolls in general, then it's even more scary. And the movie Scream Wes Craven, 1996, the original Scream. That's also a very clever movie. And I enjoyed it. So there you go. There's your horror segment here for episode 666. Let's do some wrestling questions here before we wrap up. I don't know how I'm conscious right now. I did a three-hour stream last night. I didn't get much sleep. And here we are now. I don't want to hit 3 hours here, so let's get moving. Michael in Hicksville, New York. Goldberg gave an interview and said his WWE deal runs through 2023 and calls for 2 matches per year. Who would you like to see him wrestle on those remaining matches? Do I have to? Do I have to see him wrestle anybody? Haven't we seen him against all the people that we would have wanted to see him against? Well, they promoted the match already with Roman Reigns that they never delivered on. Spear against spear. So I think the match with Roman Reigns would probably be the one that makes the most sense. The other match that we're not going to get, but I would love to see it, is Matt Riddle getting his match with Goldberg. Matt wants the match with Brock. He wants the match with Bill. They don't want to work with him, but I would love to see them in the ring together. I suspect that would not end well, though, for Matt Riddle. Not that he couldn't take Goldberg. I think if they ever got in a real fight, at this stage, Goldberg's 50, whatever he is, 53 years old. Matt has a lot of fight experience. You know, he could hold his own. Matt would twist Goldberg into a pretzel. He would twist him into a pretzel. Just like Chris Jericho got Goldberg in a front face lock. You know, when it comes to real life and real moves, you're trying to subdue somebody and take him down. I don't think Matt Riddle would have any problem handling himself against Bill Goldberg at 53 years old. But the end result of a match probably would not be to Matt Riddle's liking. Joseph and a few other people wrote into me wanting my thoughts on Rusev's comments about Vince McMahon. Rusev, or Miro, I guess, was on his YouTube channel. And he was talking about the Rusev Day shirts being sold out when Rusev Day was really at its peak of popularity. He talked about the t-shirts being sold out everywhere. They were sold out at the buildings. They were sold out on WWE Shop. They were selling like hotcakes. And if there's one way to get to Vince McMahon's heart, it's through merch. So he tells the story about talking to Vince, and he brings it up to Vince McMahon, who did not seem to know that these shirts were sold out. He appeared to be unaware of this. And he said that Vince was very flippant about it. And he said, well, maybe we just didn't make enough shirts. They're not sold out because it's a hot gimmick, because you're getting over. Oh, no, 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 no. They're sold out because we probably just didn't make enough of them. And this ties into the appearance that he made on Ryback's podcast a couple weeks ago. Rusev was on Ryback's show. And he said that he wanted to show more of his personality on TV. And he was told, don't look at the people when you come out. Don't make eye contact with them. Don't smile. Don't do this. Don't do that. All this whole list of things that you can't do. And people wonder why when people leave the company, they talk about how they felt stifled creatively in WWE. It's no wonder. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't act this way. Act, you know. And so they're telling him all of these things. And this may have been before the Rusev Day stuff really got hot. And he was incredibly frustrated by this. You know, people seem to actually be liking some of the things that he started doing. And it was as if the company didn't want him to get any more over. He talked to Vince McMahon about it. And Vince told him, the Rusev Day stuff is just the fans mocking you. His exact words were, they're fucking with you. It's not that you're over. They're making fun of you, which is a hell of a thing to say to somebody who feels like he's finally found something to help him break through. Oh, no, 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 no. It's not that the people like you. They're just mocking you. Meanwhile, it's the number one t-shirt, or one of the top shirts at the time, in the entire company. Because I know that if I wanted to mock somebody, I would spend my money to buy their fucking shirt. What does that make me? He said they started actively trying to get the chance to go away. They would put him and Aiden English on at the very beginning of the shows to try to get the chance to fizzle out. The year he lost to Jinder Mahal at WrestleMania, I think it was a Fatal 4-Way or something, WrestleMania 34, he wasn't even supposed to be on the show. He was like a late addition. in the days leading up to the show. He wasn't even originally penciled in to be on the WrestleMania card. But he said he did everything he felt that he had to do. He put the work in. He tried to, you know, he took acting classes. He transformed his body, which he did. You could see the transformation. He slimmed down. He looked good. And what was it all for? It's that feeling that a lot of WWE talents have of feeling like a hamster on a wheel. You're moving and moving and moving and spinning, but you're not really going anywhere. You know, your car is stuck in a ditch and you're trying to spin the wheels and get out of it, but you're just spinning your wheels. You're not actually moving. You're not actually going anywhere. You got to get a push. Literally, somebody has to push you out of that ditch. Well, all Rusev wanted was a push, and he's trying everything that he can do, and it's seemingly not making any kind of a difference to the people in power. And Vince says to him, they're just fucking with you. If you're not in their plans, it's very hard to get over in that company. You could do it. Daniel Bryan did. But they're going to be dragged kicking and screaming like they were going into WrestleMania 30. It is possible. It is doable. But it's almost like you're working against them. I mean, working in that company has to be just a total mindfuck for a lot of these people. I don't think I could handle it. I like dealing with people straight up. I like people dealing with me straight up. I'm not 12 years old anymore. I don't like playing games. And I feel like that's all there is. It's games. It's politics. It's games. Being told one thing to your face and then people saying another thing about you behind your back. He's better off not being there anymore. I know he said that he retired from wrestling. I'm going to become a full-time YouTuber. I think he was just being sarcastic. He's hurt. Apparently, he's got some kind of injury he's recovering from. Once he's all healed up, I guarantee you he's going to be back in the ring. But sometimes in life, you got to catch lightning in a bottle. And that's what he did with the Rusev Day stuff. It's very hard to catch lightning in a bottle twice, unless you're Ric Flair. If you're Ric Flair got struck by lightning two different times. But he's Ric Flair, so he's just a weird guy. But it's very hard to do that. It's very hard to get lightning in a bottle twice. I think he would be a great addition to the AEW roster. I know I've said that they have to be careful not to bring in too much ex-WWE talent. Rusev is one of the ones I absolutely would have brought in. So when he's available, if he's game for it, I think that would be a good landing spot for him. Conrad from Buffalo, New York, can you rank these three for who you would like to see Cody defend the TNT title against from most to least? Well, womp womp. This question was valid when I originally received it, but Cody, let's pretend that Cody is still the TNT champion. He listed JTG, Hannibal, and Mil Muertes. Mil Muertes is number one for me easily. I'd love to see him and Katrina bring their act from Lucha Underground over, even if they had to change their names, bring it over to AEW. JTG would be number two. I'd put Hannibal at number three. Hannibal has a great YouTube channel when it comes to shoot interviews and stuff. I plug it all the time. But I have no interest in seeing that as a TNT title match. None. None whatsoever. Shane from Red Deer, Alberta, Canada. Buy or sell. Razor Ramon, 1995 or Scott Hall, 1997. 1995... was not Razor Ramon's best year, aside from the ladder match, which I thought was actually a better match than their WrestleMania 10 match. That match was excellent at SummerSlam that year, but aside from that, he really didn't have a very good year. Having said that, because I much prefer the Razor from 93 and 94, having said that, I'm buying on Razor in 95. I'm selling on Scott Hall in 97. I just wasn't really a big fan of any of the stuff that Hall did in WCW. I really wasn't. I can't think of that one match or moment of Scott Hall's WCW tenure aside from the initial invasion with the Outsiders and the thing with Hogan. After that, I can't think of anything that really stood out to me as being this big Scott Hall moment. I much prefer Razor Ramon. And Zach from West Virginia, in honor of 666, buy or sell on the better film, The Omen, from 1976, or The Omen from 2006. The Omen is, you could say this about a lot of movies, The Omen did not need to be remade. So I'm going to buy on the 1976 film, sell on the 2006 film. I saw the 2006 film. It wasn't bad, but it did not need to be made. Email me your questions at thesolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter. I'm going to be live tweeting during the pay-per-view tonight. So follow me on there, and I will let you all know when I'm going live as well. Immediately after SummerSlam, join me on YouTube. Please hit that subscribe button if you are not subscribed to the channel. If you are, make sure you hit that bell and that notifications are set to all and not some or partial, because then you may not get notified when I go live. So it's very important not just to sub, but also to check your notification settings, your preferences, and make sure they're set properly. When you get into the chat, hit that thumbs up button on the video. I would appreciate that. We'll have super chats open. We'll take phone calls. We're going to have one big party. The biggest party of the summer. Tonight after SummerSlam live on YouTube, I look forward to being with you yet again on this very busy weekend of streaming and wrestling. So this has been episode 666, a devilish edition of the Sound Off. I'll be back with 667 next Sunday because we don't miss a beat around here. You guys know that. It's very rare that I miss a show. I have people sometimes when the show goes up a little bit late, oh, I guess Solomonster's not doing a show. And I'm like, really, dude? Like, really? When was the last time I missed a Sunday show? Always assume that there's a show. If it's like 6 o'clock at night and there's no show, then something is wrong. But sometimes it takes an extra hour or so. If the show is longer, you gotta edit or there's some kind of problem uploading, but I'm always here. Unlike WWE Creative, you can always rely on me. I'm very consistent. And so are a lot of you, and I thank you for all of your support. Until tonight and next Sunday, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I'll be back with you tonight, live after SummerSlam. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Edge is the guest on the Peep Show. Christian says, I think you're running out of gas. I think you're running on fumes. This is the point where the people were like, you still got it. You still got it. You still got... I'm not exaggerating. That's how cringe-inducing it was. Douche chills up and down my arm. Just make noise. That's all you need them to do. Just make noise. Cheer, yay, boo. What's next? We are awesome. Are they going to start chanting that next too?
They're going to chant what?
When somebody comes out for a promo? Oh, that'd be great. Keep the chants out of it.
The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.